everybody, we're back after a semi not super long hiatus, but maybe slightly long. Not as long as I think the last one we did. I think our last episode came online in November to celebrate Charles Bronson's birthday. I almost said Chuck Norris, and that would have been not right. Charles Bronson's birthday. And that was a few months ago. And we kind of laid back. I think we were like, we're totally going to do this all the time. And then life happened, and then I think we're back to we're totally gonna do this all the time, but bear with us if we can't get everything online in a timely manner. But we're gonna shoot for trying to do this more often. There's still so many TV movies to talk about. There's still some people that I've talked to that I'd like to have come on and talk about TV movies, and there's some ideas floating around. And just in general, I like being here and I missed my friends, so let's catch up with them. And again, my name is Amanda Reyes, for those if you're just listening for the first time. This is the Made for TV Mayhem show, and we're gonna have a really fun double tonight, I think. Before we get started, let's say hey to everybody. Hey, Nate, what's going on?
Hey, nothing much. Just hanging out. I have the day off from work tomorrow, so I'm
Nice.
very much
Oh,
looking forward to that.
how nice. You don't really get days off, do
Not usually,
you?
no.
What are you gonna do? What are you gonna do?
Nothing. I'm
That
gonna
sounds
watch movies.
nice.
so good. I did that. We had an ice storm. Did you get the ice storm, Nate?
Yeah, it wasn't really that bad here, though.
It was bad enough for us to have closed down everything, you know? And but it wasn't so bad that we lost power and everything totally died for a week like last year. But I just watched a lot of horror movies, and there's a lot of great stuff on Tubi, which I think we all know. I don't know. Do you watch Tubi a lot, Nate?
Yeah, I actually just recently watched Carousel on there,
Oh,
which is about
wow.
a carousel horse slash unicorn who comes to life and starts killing people at this party one by one.
Did you like it?
I loved it, but it's not for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that they had the Michael Krueger movies up there. You know, he did Mind Killer and Night Vision. And a really funny thing happened. I tweeted about it because I hadn't seen Night Vision before, and I was really blown away with how good it is. I've always wanted to see it. I know Dan is a big fan of Michael Krueger stuff,
Yes.
and I'd only really seen Mind Killer, which is a favorite film of mine, like an amazing discovery I made in the 90s. So, and so I tweeted about it, and somehow I got hundreds and hundreds of likes, like hundreds. And not only that, but the star of Night Vision left a comment
Oh, wow.
on my feed, and his kid left a comment on my feed, and somebody who worked in post-production on Lone Wolf, which is a
Wow.
Michael Kruger written film,
Oh, yeah.
left a comment on my feed. It was weird, but I was just posting it was on Tubi, and all these people were like, "Oh, I've never heard of this guy," and I just think it's really sad that such an amazing filmmaker has kind of flown under the radar, and I'm super happy for streaming sites like Tubi that have access, give you access to all of these great films. And so, so I spent the weekend kind of trolling it, and I ended up rewatching Anthropophagus, I think is how
Oh,
you
sure.
say it.
Grim Reaper,
And now I've
yeah.
just, yeah, now I've decided if you don't eat your own guts in a movie, I don't want to ever see it. It's just not
Not
worth it.
interested.
Yeah. So anyway, I would recommend, Nate, that you just go on Tubi, which you might do tomorrow, and just pick stuff because there's some great stuff on there.
I definitely will.
I'm so jealous of your day. Not that I just didn't have four of them because of the storm, but still. And Dan, what have you been up to?
What I've I the other day I watched a bunch of movies. I watched what I watch. I watched Death Wish 3, which is always
Ooh,
fun.
yes.
I watched Joe D'Amato's Endgame, which is pretty great. Which is a post-apocalyptic one with Laura Gemser and George Eastman and Al
Oh.
Cliver.
Yeah, that just came up recently with me, but I haven't seen it yet.
That's fun. I watched Raiders of Atlantis, or the Deodato film, which is super goofy fun. And then I forget, I watched other stuff, but those were the main ones. I had kind of like a block of them I watched on Sunday afternoon, kind of actiony, post-apocalyptic, dystopian, good time, fun. It was
Yeah.
good stuff. Yeah, and of course I watched a bunch of TV movies, of course. Of
Of
course,
course.
of
Of
course.
course.
But apart from that, you're just working, hanging out, slowly putting together the idea for my next book,
Oh.
which I had an idea for it, and I don't know if I'll mention it on here just because it's so not quite fully formed, but I had an idea like 2 weeks ago off of something someone said on Twitter regarding something I'd posted, and I mentioned it to my wife, and I said, does this sound like a stupid idea or a good idea? And she heard it and said, that sounds like a good idea. And so I'm going to... So
wow!
So
oh, I can't wait.
So it should be fun. It's going to be I've been wanting to get back to writing fiction or at least stories because that's where I began, mm-hmm. you know. And I turned to reviews and things when I couldn't get any of the damn stories or anything published. But it's going to be a mix. I think it's going to be like I won't go too far, but it's sort of a mix of reviews of something specific with stories in it. I'm still working on the setup, but that's a tease, a little tease.
This is random and has nothing to do with you really, but it reminded me of like years ago, I took a writing class taught by Dennis Etchison, you know, who wrote some of the novelizations for Halloween and stuff. Yeah, great guy. And he just passed away, I don't know, a year or so ago. And I got really inspired to try to write some horror fiction. He liked the one story that I submitted, which is slightly like Night Vision in that it's about a VHS tape that does funny things.
Oh, nice.
But I hadn't seen Night Vision yet. But I started to write this story, and apparently it was told through letters to the editor of a newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
About a Silent Night, Deadly Night type horror movie
mm-hmm.
that had come out, and somebody was really upset about the violence.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there was a serial killer in the news as well, and I found it, and I wrote half of it,
uh-huh.
and I don't know what I was doing with the story. Like, I don't know where it's supposed to
go.
Where
it's going, okay, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I found it, and I started reading it, and I was like, this is not bad for a first draft of just writing something.
I always like that. That's the kind of fiction I tend to write, is stuff that's a little, that tells a story in a slightly like different way. And I don't know if you've ever read. Do you ever read my collected movie reviews of Cyril P. Drathmore?
I don't think so. Oh, maybe.
It was a thing back in 2011 on Bleeding Skull. We did a thing where Cyril P. Drathmore. It was a separate blog, and there were 52 entries. One went up each week across the year, and it told a story in 52 newspaper articles.
Oh, that's awesome.
About this guy named Cyril P. Drathmore, and he was the movie reviewer for the small town newspaper, and he only reviews slasher films. And so it's a mix of reviews of slasher films along with an actual story that's being told about this man. And,
wow.
And that's not quite what this new one is going to be, but that's sort of in the same realm. I forget what folks, you can find online if you Google the collected movie reviews of Cyril P. Drathmore, Drathmore, I believe. You'll find that it's a blog. Start it the first week, go to the end. You'll enjoy it, especially if you like slashers.
Wow, that sounds great. Yeah, so yours were completed. Mine is just a story that's hanging in the air, and I don't know where it's supposed to go. And I don't even know where I put it now, but if I find it again, I might try to figure it out. Yeah, I thought, wow, this is not bad. And then I was like, what was I supposed to do? But I wrote two stories for Dennis Etchison. He didn't love the second one. This first one he was really a big cheerleader of, and that was really sweet of him. And that has nothing to do with what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah.
So let's veer on to. So we're covering two ABC Movie of the Weeks directed by. Now, I have been pronouncing this man's name, Jeanot Zawark, and I was pretty sure that I had the first name right and the last name maybe right, but it does turns out I don't have either one right. Apparently, it's Zano Schwark. And I'm really
shark.
Nervous.
Yeah, okay.
I'm really nervous about saying his name. While we talk, because I do not want to mispronounce it.
Sure.
And I've been mispronouncing it for as long as I've been alive, because he directed Jaws 2 when I was like 4 or 5 when that came out or something, and so I've loved him for all my life. But, like, so we decided to cover two of his films. Now, he did a lot of TV movies. He's mostly an episodic director in his early days, and then he had the spate of TV movies that he did in the 70s, and then he kind of branched out into theatricals. He got asked to do Jaws 2, which was already in production. But I think John Hancock was the director, and it was going in a weird, not a weird direction, but a direction the producers weren't happy with. And I think there were gangsters involved and stuff like that. And
flying sharks.
And yeah, and they were like, we want a different kind of angle on this. Who can we get? And I think Zano Schwark had said that he knew somebody. Oh, it was Joe Elves, right? Because he worked on Night Gallery with him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said He said, I know a guy that can do it and do it quick because he made all these TV movies. And so why don't you bring him in and interview him? And the producers loved him. And I guess he used about 10% of what John Hancock had already shot, which was very little of the film, which is my understanding. Scrapped most everything. They had to fire a lot of the teenage actors. And then bring in a new crew, which is where we got Donna Wilkes from Angel. The one person who is the same as the guy that starred in Christine, whose name is escaping me, he stayed in both the original production and then the second one that got filmed completely. And so after that, when he made the deal, he said, all I want is for you to do me a favor later. And so the producers were like, or the next studio or whatever was like, whatever, just let him. We got to get this film made. So he said, okay, I want to make a movie called Somewhere in Time.
Oh.
And so Jaws 2 was huge. It was huge. Mm-hmm. It made like $100 million. It did almost as well as the original Jaws because it was Jaws 2 and had Roy Scheider. It's a great film. In some ways, I even love it more than the original, even though I wouldn't take any argument that said that Jaws is a better film. Matter of fact, it's probably the best film ever made as far as I'm concerned. But Jaws 2 is a slasher.
Yeah.
You know, in the water. So anyway, he made Somewhere in Time, which is this beautiful time travel love story with Jane Seymour and Christopher Reeve. And he loved working with Christopher Reeve. He enjoyed working with Jane Seymour. He said that a lot of people have told him that that's her best performance. And I think she's had a career of really great performances. And but people seem to really love her in this film in particular. And he did Supergirl and he did a couple other things, but he wasn't really.
I quite like Supergirl. I watched that the other day. Yeah.
I have it. I've never seen it. I actually got it because I bought a movie from Anchor Bay. It was a Dario Argento movie. And the disc was faulty.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that they had all these Argento movies come out right when DVD was a thing at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so you were supposed to send them the disc back but keep the case, which I did. And they sent me back a new disc and a copy of Supergirl because, you know, they mm-hmm. released it and they hardly sold any copies.
Yes.
Of it.
I was going to say, I have whatever the Blu-ray is that came out a year ago. And I hadn't seen it since I saw bits of it on HBO back in the day. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's not great. It feels a little like there are a couple different versions on there, so it feels like they didn't get it quite right. Maybe there were a few too many gangsters for the producers, and they wanted to get rid
maybe.
Of the director. But it's fun.
Struggled, with his. Yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was going to say they do something that I love where they always forget that the two big things that Superman and Supergirl are vulnerable to is kryptonite, which they did to Superman all the time in the movies, and magic. Which is what they do in Supergirl. Yeah. So it's actually pretty. I think it's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it's really good. But then the year after that, he did Santa Claus the movie,
hey!
Which I've seen because it has Jeffrey Kramer from Jaws and Jaws 2 in it, mm-hmm. and I'm obsessed with Jeffrey Kramer. I actually went on Twitter one day and said I had a crush on him, and he liked my tweet.
Yeah.
I could have died. So anyway, I have a diehard crush on him. Anyway, I think he had a really hard time. Getting that kind of match that success he got with Jaws 2. And so he kind of went back to television. He ended up doing a lot of episodic television again with some TV movies thrown back in the 90s. He did a couple of the Rockford File reunion movies, which are quite good. And then he would go on to do like Ally McBeal, JAG, The Practice. I think he did Heroes, Cold Case, Smallville, Fringe, Supernatural, Scandal, Castle Bones. I mean, you name it, he directed it. Grey's Anatomy. His last credit was 2019, but he's still with us. And he is somebody that we should probably pay attention to because he's probably one of the last of the TV movie directors from the Golden Age that is still with us because he started his career very young. And I think he started really on Night Gallery, and he was maybe 30 at the time. Well, he started before that. He was directing Ironside and things like that. But I feel like Night Gallery is kind of what got him sort of his foot really in the door. And so he was born in Paris, France, and he was apparently a huge film buff even as a teen. And he said as a child, he saw about 300 films a year, and he started a film society as a teenager. So he's always been a big fan of film. He did some really interesting TV movies at the time. He did the two movies we'll be talking about tonight, which is You'll Never See Me Again and Night of Terror. He did a movie called The Weekend Nun. He did Lisa Bright and Dark, and he did A Summer Without Boys. Those all-star Kay Lenz, who would go on to make The Initiation of Sarah and do a lot of amazing things. So his movie The Weekend Nun, which actually stars Joanna Pettit as a nun who's also a probation officer, is based on a true story. It was a pilot, if you can believe that, that didn't take off. And Kay Lenz plays it like a troubled teenager. Clint Eastwood saw it and he liked it so much he hired Kay Lenz to star in Breezy. So Jeannot Zwart got everybody started. He's and he also did The Devil's Daughter, which is a classic ABC Movie of the Week horror film. Have either one of you seen that one?
I have not.
No, I've seen To the Devil a Daughter,
Yeah, me
but
too.
it's a different movie.
Different movie. Yeah, no, The Devil's Daughter stars Belinda Montgomery, Shelley Winters, also in The Initiation of Sarah, and Abe Vigoda and Jonathan Frit.
Nice.
It's really good. It's also got that woman we love so much from Duel who runs the like snake farm. Lucille
Oh,
Benson, the old
yes.
lady. Yeah. She's great in it. And so he did the spate of like TV movies and then he did theatricals and then he came back to TV and I think he's primarily known for his work there. And Night of Terror, I found out, won an Emmy for best cinematography. So because of that, it actually has a little bit of documentation. The other film, I had a really hard time finding anything on about it. So there's not going to be a lot of trivia and like background on these films. I think what we're going to do is we're just going to dive in. I think we'll do them chronologically. So we'll start it with Night of Terror. I believe that one aired first. And
Yes.
then we'll just talk about them. And we do actually have one piece of feedback, which is really nice because I'm surprised anybody has stuck with us through the very sporadic recording sessions we've been doing. But anyway, Dan, why don't you get us started with Night of Terror?
All right, Night of Terror, we get Linda Daniel, who's Donna Mills, who I shares an apartment with Celeste Davilo, played by Kathy Burns, and they live on like the fourth floor of an apartment building. And one day they are teaching a they do a weekly painting class for local kids, and all of a sudden, outside their door on this small like walkway at the top of the on the fourth floor there, a bunch of hoodlums show up and start beating up on a guy, and Chuck Connor shows up and starts to push the guy around. They're looking for something that the guy has, and he says he doesn't have it, and it gets a little unpleasant when they begin to strip him. And Donna Mills hears that. Well, her character Linda hears the noises outside, pokes her head out, and there are all these gangster type guys there. You didn't see nothing, lady. Get back in there. So she goes back in there, and oh, what the heck is going on? And the next day, they find the guy who was being attacked dead. The police show up and talk to Linda and Celeste.
Pete Manning was a running for the syndicate, Miss Daniels.
Manning, he's the one that was killed.
That's right. Delivery boy. Ran numbers, peddled junk, anything for a quick buck. Can you tell me why he was outside your apartment?
I have absolutely no idea. Really, I told the officer that last night.
How about the man who pulled the door shut?
I looked right past him.
To the big man, whose face is now a complete blank.
Lieutenant, it all just happened too fast.
Can you tell me about your classes?
Lindy and I give art classes to the neighborhood children once a week after work. Why are you asking about our classes?
Manning was searched and stripped before he was killed. Obviously, those three men were looking for something. Are you sure he didn't leave anything with you? A package? An envelope? Anything?
No, nothing. Never. I'm sorry, Lieutenant. We just can't help you.
I want you to understand one thing, girls, and don't take it too lightly. Manning was dangerous, and the men that killed him are very dangerous.
This town is full of dangerous people. It has nothing to do with us.
It has everything to do with you. Those men were looking for something. They didn't find it. They think you've got it. They'll be back.
Lieutenant, that man never got into our apartment. He never left anything there. Honest.
Mr. Villo, Manning was scared, and he was running, and he ran to your apartment. I want to know why.
We don't know.
Thank you both.
He was really trying to scare us.
And the policeman says, just take care of yourself. And but Linda's kind of, eh. Celeste is a little bit more worried about it. That evening, while Linda is sitting at a bus stop with Ralph Monroe from Green Acres, Celeste is attacked by two gangsters who break into their apartment, wanting to know where, I forget exactly what they're after, but they're after something and they believe she has it or it's in the apartment. And Linda comes back and Celeste has been beaten pretty badly. So she's staying in the hospital and Linda sort of isn't getting much done with the police. And but she's a little more aware than she was. Eventually, Celeste leaves the hospital, and for some reason, Linda lets Celeste drive out of the hospital where she stayed. And as they're leaving, they're at the top of the parking garage in the hospital. As they're leaving, suddenly Chuck Connors appears. I'm gonna skip ahead slightly here because there's a nice little twist-a-roo here that I didn't expect. It's about we're about a third of the movie at this point, and there's a nice little twist-a-roo, and I'll just say Celeste is killed, and Linda has to go into more or less protective custody with Martin Balsam, which is a dream of many. And
why?
He basically,
for sure.
He plays Captain Sark, Caleb Sark. And he has, like, this house he uses in the middle, kind of a safe house in the middle of nowhere. He takes her there, and we'll talk about what has happened to her, but they sort of develop a relationship, like a father-daughter kind of relationship as they're there, and they kind of become good friends. But meanwhile, the gangsters are still trying to find out what happened to her, and eventually there will be a reckoning. And I will stop there. That's the very basics of Night of Terror.
Awesome. So I know you and I have seen this before, Dan, and we'll talk
yes.
a little bit about that. But Nate, had you ever seen this before?
No, I actually feel like I had gotten it confused with Not Terror.
Yeah.
So when I was watching it, yeah, it was definitely a first time watch for me.
What'd you think of it?
I thought it was a lot of fun. I liked the cast because I think everybody in the cast was fantastic. And I thought it was interesting how the movie kind of reminded me of Wait Until Dark,
Ooh,
you know, the Audrey Hepburn
yeah.
movie. Like, it kind of reminded me of that in a way. I was really glad to see, I guess this is a semi-spoiler, but semi-spoiler, please skip ahead. but I was really glad to see Donna Mills' character like fight back, because most of the movie she kind of comes across more of the, you know, damsel in distress kind of thing. But like when, you know, faced with danger at the end, she becomes much more proactive, which I thought was, you know, like it was nice, you know, to see her, you know, fight back, especially when she kind of gets the bad guy on equal footing with her, so to speak.
Ooh, nice play with words.
Yes,
thank
very
you.
Nice.
But, I mean, overall, I thought it was a good movie. I probably, if I had any kind of complaint, it may have been I might have added some more of the kind of scary sequences, I guess.
Sure.
Kind of hard to explain from that perspective, but yeah, like I probably would add a little bit more horror, but you guys know I'm a horror fanatic, so that's probably why. Yeah, overall, I mean, I thought it was a good movie. I felt bad for Donna Mills though, because, you know, when the nurse is trying to give her some tough love, I'm like, well, cut her some slack. I mean. You know,
Bronski.
I mean, she was just in a horrible like crash, and her friend's dead. Although I will say, speaking of Celeste, before the crash, she was handling that vehicle pretty well, swinging those curves.
Yeah.
I think she missed her calling to be a race car driver.
Maybe that was a pretty spectacular car accident. I mean, for. So the movie was shot like in 10 days or something ridiculous like that. So the fact that it has the look that it does is pretty spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it only like 1 hour and 14 minutes long. I mean, it goes by very quickly, you know, it doesn't feel like it drags at all. So
yeah.
Well-paced movie.
Awesome. Okay. So, Last year, I was asked to do a commentary for the movie Night Terror, the Valerie Harper Night Terror. And Nate couldn't make it, so Dan and I did it. And one of the things we did was we made a list of movies that reminded us a little of Night Terror. And one of them happened to be Night of Terror, right? And we thought it would be funny because it had, not funny, but maybe fun to talk about because it had, it's a play on the title because they're so closely aligned. And we were both really charmed by the film, but I don't think we ended up talking about it on the commentary because we ended up just talking about so many other things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had it in the back of my mind that I thought, oh, this would be a great film to cover because I really like it. Like, I don't know that it's like a great film in the way you think of great films, mm-hmm. but it's a really good, solid movie that I think does a lot with very little and has really amazing actors. I think it's got good suspense. I think it's a great story. I love that if you're going to have a love story in a film, it doesn't have to be a romantic love story. It could be a love story between a woman yes. and a man who built this father-daughter relationship. And somehow it managed to have a really happy ending too. And so there's just something about this film that I find so charming that I can't get enough of it. It's just, it's really well written and well made. And it's got, like you said, these characters. I already have it in my background, but one of the things that Kevin Thomas of the LA Times said was that he thought that Agnes Moorehead and Martin Balsam brought so much warmth to the film. And I think that's what it is. It's a very warm film for me, even though all this horrible stuff is happening. And boy, does horrible stuff happen to Donna Mills' character. But it's still got this warmth to it. And there's just something about it that I just really like. And I know, Dan, you were pretty charmed by it. What did you think about it this time?
Oh, yeah, the same. I was actually... Two quick things about our commentary. I think the reason why we didn't mention Night of Terror, or really quite a few of the movies that we'd watch, is because when we started to work on that commentary, I think we both thought we were doing the 90-minute version.
That's right.
And so, like, 3 days before recording, I had notes for minutes, everything very specifically laid out. 3 days before recording, it was like, oh, you're doing the 73-minute version. So suddenly it was like, I know I was rushing with my notes to see, okay, what can I take out? So it got a little crazy trying to get in everything that we were supposed to. But I have been told by more than one person that it's a good commentary. And when I say more than one person, I don't mean just me. I mean people who aren't me. So, and the other thing was, I did also watch Night of Horror, the Tony Malinowski film.
Oh, the same. It's the same movie.
Because I will have any excuse to watch Night of Horror is what I will use. But anyway, yeah, I watched the film again. I do quite enjoy it. It moves, like Nate said, it's got a really nice pace. I like the fact that if you had been watching it a 90-minute time slot for the first half hour or so, you think it's going to be like a She Cried Murder all the way through kind of thing. But then all of a sudden there's the accident, and it kind of twists and turns a bit and becomes something different for a while. And it becomes, you know, this story about a woman who, you know, can't use her legs, and Agnes Moorehead is going to help her, and Martin Balsam's going to help her, but there is the threat in the background of the killers coming after her. So, and almost, it's funny, I almost think, I wouldn't have wanted this, but I almost think it could have been a longer movie and save that sort of, and made more out of the time they spend together. In the, yeah. Almost like a Witness kind of thing, mm-hmm, almost, you sure. know, with, but I like the length it was at, though. But, yeah, I think that there's something about it that it's going along and it's suspenseful. I mean, I will say, I don't know if it was just me, maybe I was in a mood, but I'm sure the cop and the doctors were just trying to be helpful, but boy, they're kind of jerky towards Linda through I know it's their job and they see a lot of crap, but they were kind of a bit too jerky.
I tend to agree with you on that, because I was thinking about, how is this the same hospital from Hospital Massacre with Barbie Benton?
Because what the guys looked like.
People are so mean.
Lindy, I'm Dr. Whittaker. Can you hear me, Lindy? Lindy?
coming to. We have arm movement. The compression didn't go up to the cervical area. That's good. Can you wiggle your toes, Lindy? Lindy, I want you to move your toes.
What time is it?
Now, Lindy, tell me what you feel and where you feel it, all right?
Tell me when.
Now, tell me what you're feeling.
It doesn't hurt.
Feel dull? Sharp? What?
It doesn't feel anything. Where's Celeste?
Now, you were shaken up in the accident, Lindy, and your legs and your back will be sort of numb for a while. Your hands will be just fine in a few days. Do you have any questions?
Is Celeste Avila all right?
Well, she's not my patient, Lindy. And Dr. Kennard and myself will be looking in on you a few times every day, okay?
Doctor... Every day? For how long?
Well, I plan on at least a couple of weeks.
Weeks?
Like the Hospital Massacre guys, they just kind of stand there looking at her. Now, they don't have a really cool x-ray that looks like she has, like, metal worms in her intestines or something. But it's still like they're looking... It's they could be more pleasant, I guess is what I'm saying. And the cop could be that way, too, because a lot of his... He's almost hostile towards them. When he's talking, I mean, I know what he's trying to do when he's talking to Lyndon Celeste on the steps. He's trying to say, hey, they might come after you, be careful. But he's kind of doing it in a jerk way.
Maybe yeah, I guess it makes the relationship she has with Martin Balsam that much sweeter.
Sweeter, yes, yeah. Exactly, yeah. And the moment they get together and they go, I mean, I love when they pull up to this big house.
Well, it's like we did it.
But you're not sure.
Sure as I need to be. Lindy, this place is called Ocean View. It's private. It's got a gasoline station. Boat rental. 2x4 diner. And the general store where I order the supplies. And that's about it. And how do you like it? It was built by one of the families along the railroad.
Do you own it now?
So what? What kind of a cop do you think I was? No, the family was very close friends of ours. Up you go. All right? Mm-hmm. There we go. There you go. All right?
Yeah.
Hang on. There you are.
Thank you. You said there was an elevator.
Yes, there's an elevator and ramps for a wheelchair. You see, one of the kids was...
It's crippled? Mr. Saar, you know you smoke too much?
Well, let's go. Brick's off.
Yeah.
Got it? Mm-hmm. There we go.
For like the second act, it kind of becomes another movie. And while I would have preferred maybe a little more scary stuff in there, I did kind of like the way for a bit, it truly felt like, hey, maybe they'll never find her. Maybe everything will be fine. Now, that's not going to happen, obviously. But for a few brief moments, there was time where I got sort of caught up in their relationship. And, you know, like, he's trying to get her to walk. She's trying to get him to quit smoking. And there's just this kind of lovely relationship between the two of them. There's a good-looking guy who comes over delivering groceries whenever everyone needs to go, ah, who's that? And he shows up. But it's nice in that it did make me forget for a few moments here and there that there were crazy killers, including Chuck Connors, after her, which is kind of, I think, kind of nice. And then when they do come after, it's pretty, it gets rough, but it ends well. That's
Yeah,
right.
it does. It manages to. So this is what we'll talk about, having happy endings. So one of the things, and by the way, I have to apologize. I only have one rat now, but he still manages to make enough noise for two. So if you hear that in the background, I've been trying to mute it out, but I think I keep clicking back on, thinking it's safe, and then he finds a toy or something. So I think the twist that you were avoiding talking about until this point, and I guess that maybe we should say maybe people should see the film if they're interested before they listen. I'm not sure. It's not like a spoiler that ruins. There's no mystery to the film. Like, we know who the bad guy is, but it does take kind of a dark turn in that Donna Mills's character is trying to leave the hospital with her friend Celeste, who's really been up a tree and back. I mean, like, her, it's she looks like she's really been through it, and she's been traumatized, and she gets in the car, and then they get in this car accident, and then she dies, and Donna Mills survives, but she's paralyzed. And so, like, a good portion of the film is about her dealing with her paralysis, and including going to a home that is safe for her to be in that it has an elevator. It's a really neat home, which does not exist. The exteriors are real, but the interiors were made at Paramount. Of this really neat multi-story house that was equipped for wheelchair access, and so a lot of the film involves her kind of. I wouldn't say that Donna Mills's character. One of the things I like about her, it's never a pity party, because she. It does have trouble, and she kind of doesn't want to push forward with a lot of the physical therapy. And I know Bronski, played by Agnes Moorehead, kind of pushes her. But, like, she says things like, something really bad just happened to me, and I'm terrified, and I don't feel like she's like this, like, weak in the knees girl. I feel like she's realistically dealing with a lot of horrible stuff happening one thing after the other for like a long period of time for her. And so, like, there's a survival instinct, but it's sort of buried underneath this actually palpable, realistic kind of fear that you would have if this had happened to you. And I think it's prevented her recovery. But there is a large portion of the movie where Martin Balsam takes her back to the house, and they deal with this fact that she doesn't necessarily, she's not working to get better, and he has to kind of tangle with her. And then he tells her this story about his wife that turns out to not be the sto a real story, but something to get her sort of motivated. To get better, and it's such a sweet thing, right? And so like you kind of fall into like this sort of almost drama inside a thriller or melodrama even, and then it goes right back to being a thriller like in the last 15 minutes, and like it's very good. And then there's a couple moments there, like there's like the phone man comes over,
Oh
and Martin Balsam
yeah.
sticks a gun in his stomach, and he's like, "I'm gonna fix your doorbell,"
Yeah,
because.
Martin Balsam sneaks up on someone. I don't think that has that ever happened before.
I
I
don't
guess it maybe
know.
ha but yeah, like the phone guy comes in and all of a sudden Martin Balsam's right there with the gun. He's like, "Well done, Mr. B."
He's on it. He's on it. And so it's this really neat kind of drama thriller thing that kind of mixes a couple things together in a very, you're one of the things I love that you said, Dan, was that you said you wished, not wished, you said you're happy with the length that it's at, but it could also have been longer. And so many times I think the argument is, I wish it was shorter. And so this is a movie that does not outstay its welcome.
No, it does not.
So
Their relationship, yeah, is sweet enough and develops enough, just enough, so that when the bad returns, it's just enough. You're like, yeah, okay, let's do it. Let's do this.
yeah, it's a kind of an interesting the way it plays out, because so to go back to the beginning, Donna Mills's character Linda and her friend Celeste, played by Katherine Burns, are they work at like this after their day job. Once a week, kids come over to their apartment and they do things like draw or something, and like it's sort of like them being school teachers, which, by the way, makes the end, if we talk about the very very last scene of the film, makes the end even better, because she has a real affinity for children. And then there's that last shot of her with the kids in the field. That's so amazing. But and then they don't live in a very great neighborhood, so there's some calamity outside, and Joan Carlin is the victim, who you probably recognize from Dark Shadows and a bunch of Dan Curtis productions and a bunch of other stuff, and he's amazing. And he gets killed, and then but they're looking for what they keep saying, like a package, I think.
I think
Where's
so, yeah.
yeah, where's the package? Where's the package? And it turns out that she does have the clue, in that it's actually a ticket to a bus station or something where the package is, right? And it ends up in this kid's artwork. And am I right that it's John Carlin's kid, or is it just a kid?
I actually kind of forgot that what it was. Because I remember the moment you saw it, because the kid makes a collage, and he just puts a lot of stuff in it. And I was unsure exactly whose kid it was.
Yeah. There's a couple of loopholes in this one, because I think that's a general question that's like, I'm not quite sure how he got the ticket, but I kind of feel like they say it's his kid. But if it's his kid, don't you think
surely
the
he
police...
would have not? Yeah, they would have said, he would have knocked at the door and said, "Hey, is my kid there?" And someone would have said, "Daddy, daddy."
Yeah, that's right. Or the police would have been like, "Oh, it's the victim's son. Mm-hmm. I should probably ask him some questions about his dad."
Jeez, I really feel like I knew where he got that ticket from that he put in the collage, and now that you're saying it, I don't remember at all. Why don't I?
Yeah, I don't know why that's like a weird like gap in my... Do you remember anything about that, Nate?
I mean, I just remember that they find the ticket in the collage, and it has the man who got murdered's name on the back. I remember that, but I don't remember other than that.
Yeah, where the heck you got it from, yeah.
It's like this weird Bermuda Triangle that we're in.
This one plot point, none of us know it.
I feel like it was hazy the first time I watched it, too, for some reason. Maybe it's just it's casually introduced, and we just looked over it. I'm not sure. It could be.
Yeah.
But you know, from there... They realize that they have this important thing, but then Chuck Connors is on her tail the entire time, and yet there's like this huge gap of him not being there. But Chuck Connors is really good in this, and I don't remember him talking a whole lot. He just kind of shows up and he's Chuck Connors, right?
Yeah, he's just huge, and he beats up on John Carlin. Like I said, they kind of takes his shirt off and they kind of take his pants down a bit to try to find out what's going on. I thought, what are you searching for on him?
Love.
Love, just love. We're in a hallway of love.
So it's kind of funny. So I did the commentary. I feel like I'm promoting stuff we did, but I did the commentary for Nightmare in Bottom County. And one of the things I did was I researched Chuck Connors, who plays, you know, the evil guard in it or whatever. And I remember Lynn Moody, who plays one of the women that's trapped in the work farm, told a story about Chuck Connors because they shot it in the South. And where they went so far deep into the South that they were actually shooting a place that was still segregated. And so Lynn Moody, who's black, had to stay like somewhere separate. And maybe I'm wrong about it being segregated, but there was a lot of tension with race there. And some white people came up to her and harassed her, and Chuck Connors came to her defense. And so she had this really warm feeling towards him. And I would imagine, even if he wasn't famous, just having him... He's 6'5", right? So and by the way, this is a night of tall people, because Bo Svenson's in the next movie and he's 6'7", and I think David Hartman's 6'5", too.
He's pretty darn tall, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of tall people in this. So Chuck Connors just showing up is going to terrify you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a few years before Taurus Trapp, where he'd really go to town.
Oh, yeah. And yet he's, like, protecting this woman, you know? And so now when I see him in anything, I just have all these soft, warm feelings for him. And he's just not scary to me. I just think about Lynn Moody.
I think when I was growing up, one of the... In the mid-80s, there was a station where, and I've mentioned this before, there was a station they used to show from 4 to 5:30, and every Monday through Friday, they'd show Hazel, Father Knows Best, and Green Acres. But then right after Green Acres was The Rifleman.
It's a good
Chuck
show.
Connors. Yeah, and I wouldn't always watch that always all the way through, because by that time it was dinner time. But I would always see the opening and the first few minutes of each episode. You get to love Chuck Connors being the big old rifleman in that.
Yeah, he's great. He was a great actor, and he had a really wide... But I guess, because I grew up in the 80s and stuff, I'm used to him being on Werewolf and Tourist Trap, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he played very menacing characters really well, and so it was kind of implanted in my brain. So he was perfectly cast here, but now I just think of him as a big old teddy bear. So I'm just like, oh,
agreed.
Chuck Connor, squeeze the cheek. And I guess I feel that way about Martin Balsam all the time. Anyway.
Yes. When he shows up, it's so great, because you don't you saw his name in the opening credits, but it's like 25 minutes or so before he shows up, and then he just kind of randomly walks in the door. You're like, it's Martin Balls!
You get all excited, yeah. He's so good. He's such a wonderful actor. Yeah, like we talked about, this movie is just full of really warm characters. And I guess we haven't talked too much about Agnes Moorehead, who plays the nurse in the hospital. And she's kind of the tough love kind of nurse. Mm-hmm. But she's really sweet, too. Like, she's concerned about her patient. Yes. And she tries to push her, but she never pushes too hard. And then, but the funny part is Martin Balsam comes and he's like, okay, so I've been hired by your boss. So she must have this amazing boss. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to protect you until we can figure out what's going on and catch this Chuck Connors guy that's terrorizing you. And so he's like, I'm taking you somewhere and we're going to leave really early in the morning through the back so that nobody can see where we go. And the problem is, I don't know how to take care of you because you're in a wheelchair. So then Bronski, I can't want to call him Bronski for some reason. Bronski says, give me 30 minutes to teach you. And I'm like, it really takes more than 30 minutes to teach somebody how to take care of a paraplegic. But okay. And so then the whole thing ends up with this interplay between Martin Balsam's character and Agnes Moorehead as she's fucking around with his foot. And it's like, okay, I'm not real sure. There's a lot of foot action in this. Like,
I was about to say, yeah, if you're interested in seeing Donna Mills' feet, this is the film for you.
This is the one. Yeah, there's a lot of ankle action in this. So, like, it's just how it is. But then she's like teaching him how to take care of her, and she's literally just like rolling his ankle around.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. But that seems like a really easy job. Like, I feel like I could do that. I don't need the degree.
I thought that too, and she said it only takes 30 minutes. I thought, yeah, but you have a degree or something, don't you? He's just Martin Balsam who walked in from the outside. He shouldn't be doing that, should he? But I guess he does okay with it.
He does do okay. He takes pretty good care of her. And and then we get to the part that Nate brought up, which is that she does end up defending herself, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up when we talked about Night Terror, because one of the things we wanted to talk about, and we probably did on the commentary, but we didn't hit as many films, is these TV movies where the women stand up for themselves and stick up for themselves and fight for their life can be really strong characters. And so Donna Mills' character is like this woman who loves kids. She's like a school teacher. She's not like the Donna Mills from Knots Landing. She's not like this uber glamorous, you know, shoulder pads out to here kind of character. And yet she's really strong, but in like a way that like a realistic way, I think, you know. And so I like that aspect of it a lot. And I'm glad that Nate brought it up, because I think that's probably one of my favorite parts of the film, because the second she realizes she's in danger, she starts like busting those lights. And at first I was like,
yeah,
where's the light switch? But then I thought, oh, if she busts the lights, he can't turn them on. Mm-hmm. So yeah, she's actually like thinking ahead, right? And it's just such a great like cat and mouse scene.
Yeah, it's a really nicely done scene, I think.
Yeah, I think this movie's aided really well. I think I understand why it won Best Cinematography. So I didn't realize it won that till after I rewatched the movie. But looking back on it, one of the things, I think Howard Schwartz is the name of the cinematographer, one of the things that Howard Schwartz talked about was the lighting and also like shooting some of the scenes. And he went into a lot of great detail. He did an interview with American Cinematographer when he won the Emmy. And he talked a lot about low lights and key lights and things I don't fully understand because I don't make films myself, but about how they put the film together in such a short period of time and made it look like that. And when you think back to it, like, I don't remember where it happens, but there's a great scene with Chuck Connors. It must be while he's at the house at the end, and he's just a shadow.
Yeah.
And it's super menacing, you know? And it's just little things like that that the film does to keep you really into what's happening and invested in everything. And so they did a really good job with it. But at the same time, I feel like there's not a ton to say about it. Is there anything you guys wanted to add?
I think I did want to mention the cast list, she's listed as Chair Lady. I don't know why she's listed as chair lady, but Mary Grace Canfield is at the bus stop.
Oh, that's right.
Talks to Donna Mills' character.
Oh, I think it's Char Lady.
Is it Char Lady? Yeah. Oh, okay. I was going to say, I thought it was Char Lady, but I'm looking in. I've got my trusty copy of Merrill right here, and it says Chair Lady. I thought, that doesn't make sense. Okay, Char Lady.
She's in a chair.
She's in a chair. But it's always nice to see a Ralph Monroe outside of the away from Hooterville. Doing the carpentry. It was nice to see her. It's because this is what this is a year or so, a year and a half after Green Acres ended.
That was kind of an important scene for me because she's just kind of rambling and she's like, "Do you work at so and so? I work there. It's awful." And I was like thinking, is she working for Chuck Connors and trying to get information out of her?
Well, maybe, yeah.
But that never came to play. But I actually thought she was going to be an important figure.
And she does say something that struck home with me, and that's when you work in like an office building and you can't use the toilets on the floor you're on, you have to go to other floors. That's a pain in the ass, if you'll pardon my French.
Yeah, it can't
be. Do better than that. If you're running the building, make the toilets should work. That's all I ask for. I can take the steps. I don't need the elevator. Make the toilets work.
I think that's Char Lady's
thing.
Her complaint, too.
It was nice to see her when she said, "Hey, there's Donna Mills and Ralph."
Well, there was a lot of great. So we've talked about most of the people who were in it that would be well known, but also David Spielberg plays the Doctor, and he's a really, really well known face. And of course, I'm blanking on everything he's been in, but you've seen him in 10,000 things. He's so wonderful. And so, like, there's just all these amazing character actors that show up through the film. I didn't actually know much about Catherine Burns, who plays Celeste.
Yeah, neither did I. Yeah.
But she did a handful of movies, and I feel like she got nominated for an Oscar for something. Of course, now I'm drawing a blank. But she would end up becoming a writer on a soap opera that aired for 1 year on the Fox network in 1990 called Tribes, which I'd never heard of. And somebody's uploaded the first 78 episodes on YouTube, and I just died. Yeah, when I saw that. So she wrote like the first 15 episodes of it.
Wow.
Yeah, super cool. But otherwise, I wasn't too familiar with her. But otherwise, I mean, it's just a bunch of really capable actors kind of being given a pretty solid script by a man named Cliff Gould and letting Schwark. I feel so bad. Like, I'm totally going to just butcher his name here and there. Schwark. Really take the reins and, like, just make a good, solid little film.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's where the made-for-TV movie excels. And I kind of think that's a problem for us because I find that when we really like a movie, we're like, oh, yeah, and then that's it. You know what I mean? Because, because the thing about these TV movies, especially the early ones, is that they do really, like, kind of go from point A to point B without a lot of hassle in between.
They do, yeah.
And I like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You just sit there and you don't have to worry about being weighed down by a lot of subplots or keeping track of people or anything like that. And it's good, but then I feel like sometimes when we talk about the movie, maybe we don't push how good it is.
I do. I think one of the things with like Night of Terror, Night Terrors, She Cried Murder, is they're all the same basic starting point, a woman in danger being pursued by someone. But they do. I think the joy of it. It's almost like listening to like an album by a band that you love. You know, you hear the first song, and it's great, and then you hear the other songs in the album, and you're hopefully they're not all going to be the same. You're going to get some nice variations. You're going to get some different moods. You're going to get some different feelings. And it's almost like watching like Night of Terrors is this kind of woman in danger kind of movie where she gets to a safe house and she actually has time to relax. You know, Night Terrors is where she doesn't have any time to relax. And She Cried Murder is, well, it's Telly Savalas after Linda Day. You know, and I think to me the joy of these, especially these early TV movies, the 90-minute ones, is that, yeah, they generally set it up and then they do it. And there's not a lot of asides. It just goes, like you said, from point A to point B, and they're very entertaining. And the joy is if you look deep enough, you can find variations on all the different plot lines and stories and things, and hopefully you can enjoy many of them. I know I have.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way to put it, because you're right. They're all kind of, they've got the same blueprint, but they're all doing something totally different inside of them. And at the same time, and, you know, I've talked about this, and I'm not going to go too deep into it, but, like, they've got these really dynamic women playing these really, like, kind of quietly strong characters. Like, all those three movies that you've talked about, Night Terror, Night of Terror, and She Cried Murder, all have kind of really quiet heroines that proved to be really resilient, really resourceful, much stronger than people originally gave them credit for, smart, you know, but they're all dealing with different situations. And so it's kind of nice. I kind of want to do a triple.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it does occur to me, too, that the when we're watching the movies now, we sort of separate them all out and things as if they were almost regular movies. You know, like, oh, I watch this movie today, and 6 months later I watch this movie. But these movies were coming week after week.
Yeah.
You know, they were going. I mean, I'm just looking right here. Oh, my gosh. 2 days before Night of Terror, the first Heck Ramsey film.
Wow, it was aired. A great night. Richard Boone.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, when you just look, if you look at a list of all the movies and when they aired, especially the first edition of Merrill does them in order, and you just see how many of these movies came out. It's almost like episodes of a TV show. You know, when you watch Columbo, you want something comfortable, but you also want to go into a place that you haven't been to before.
Yeah, and that's a tough balance.
It's tough to do, yeah, because you can get caught in a rut. Really quick, or you can do stuff that's too sort of wacky or strange for people to come back to sometimes.
Yeah, you know, another supernatural movie that I would add to this list that also was an ABC Movie of the Week is that we covered it many, many moons ago, Revenge with Shelley Winters, where she has Bradford Doman in the cage.
Yeah.
Because you remember the woman in that, the housewife, and I can never remember the actress's name. She hires a psychic to help her find her husband, played by Stuart Whitman, but finds out he's a fraud, and then she dives into her own female intuition to find him. And it's another one of those where you don't expect the woman to be as resourceful as she is.
Yes.
And then she comes and brings it out and is the hero. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of that happening on TV back then, and it was really cool, you know. Yeah. And that's probably why as an adult I'm still so drawn to a lot of these movies, because of that component of these women. Yeah. And also the element of the horror and the suspense and thrillers.
Yes, it is nicely done. If it were shabby, we'd spot it. We wouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah. So did you want to add anything else, Dan?
Oh, I just wanted to say, if Stuart Whitman had walked in instead of Martin Balsam, would you have had the same warm feeling?
Yes. Oh, it would have been warm. It would have been warm all over.
What? Yeah, it's funny. When I said the movies I watched the other day, the other one was Blazing Magnum, Shadows in an Empty Room.
Oh.
With Stuart Whitman, the sort of semi-slasher, I don't know how you say it, semi-giallo, semi-police.
Tisa Farrow's in it, yeah.
Yeah, Tisa Farrow and Martin Landau, and it's really good. It's got a great car chase. It's got some creepy moments, and a helicopter blown up in the end.
There you go.
And it's Stuart Whitman, like, at his maddest.
Oh, I love him. I have so much warm feelings for him, and I crush on him hard. And he's just amazing. There's just something about him that especially that era, that early 70s era Stuart Whitman, is like everything to me.
I would have liked him and Martin Balsam to have done like a cop film together or something. Just maybe, two cops on the last case together.
Maybe they have. We haven't covered every TV movie.
I'm looking through the book.
Yeah. We're desperate for that.
But that's all I have.
Okay. So let me do a little background here, and then we'll move on to the next movie. So this originally aired on October 10th, 1972. It was, again, an ABC Movie of the Week. It came in at number 24 for this season. That's a pretty good rating. With a 23.3/35, which just roughly means that, I think I've gotten the rating systems right now, 35% of households with televisions that were watching TV the night the movie originally aired were tuned in to Night of Terror. So that's a third of America, right, basically watching.
Yes.
And then it ran against on CBS. Oh, I wanted to talk about this. Let me tell you what it ran against on NBC first. Bonanza and an episode of The Bold Ones. So that's a big powerhouse night of TV. And then on CBS, it ran against Hawaii Five-0, half an hour of it. And then it ran against a TV movie that I love and that we should probably cover called Visions, which stars Monty Markham. And as a matter of fact, I know what movie I'm going to double it with. It stars Monty Markham as, I think he's a professor who has psychic visions of a mad bomber.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, have you seen it? Monty Markham.
No, it's next in the Merrill book.
Oh, okay.
Because they're in order. So Visions is right here. Subsequently titled Visions of Death, directed by Lee H. Katzin. Yes.
Yes. And I'll be honest, if I was old enough to have I would have been a year old when this aired, but if I had been old enough to choose, I probably would have picked Visions, because I love Monty Markham, and also I love that movie. So so that was a tough night of TV right there. Two really good TV movies. Like I said, it was shot in 10 days. The exteriors of the house were located in Malibu. But like I said, the filmmakers couldn't find a house that was set up like they wanted with the wheelchair access and the elevator. So they created that on the Paramount lot. According to cinematographer Howard Schwartz, this is a quote from him. It was a 90-minute minus commercials, ABC, Tuesday movie of the week, and we had 10 shooting days plus an extra day of second unit for the car chase stuff in the garage. That's a pretty short schedule for a picture involving locations, but what made it workable was the fact that the key people were given a week of preparation by our production manager, Sam Stringus, or Stringus. That much preparation was a big plus on the show. On a show like this, we had a chance to visit the locations with the director and talk about how all the shots would be made. I can't stress too strongly the importance of pre-production planning on a show like this. You can do so much if you have a good production manager who will really swing with you and a director who knows in advance what he wants. So they did spend some time on this, even though they had a very short shooting schedule. There was a lot of preparation, a lot of thought went into this film. So that might be why it has this great kind of feel and look to it. And like I said, it was written by a man named Cliff Gould, who was primarily an episodic writer. He did Black's Magic. He did The Devlin Connection. He did a lot of stuff. He did a TV movie that I'd never heard of from 1973 titled Hunter, which, according to IMDb, goes like this. A fatal crash at a racetrack injures a government agent and exposes an enemy brainwashing scheme. It's an unsold pilot. And I can't remember who stars in it, but it's somebody like John Vernon, I think. So that's definitely something I need to see. And I think it has gotten a DVD release. And I mentioned Catherine Burns wrote for a show called Tribes, which is a soap opera. But one of the coolest things I thought was when the delivery boy shows up at the Malibu house, I kept thinking, is that the guy from Claudio Fragasso? Is that how you say it? Night Killer?
Was it?
That's the guy that kidnaps Tara Buchman.
Oh, yes, he's attacked in the bathroom at one point.
Yes, that's right. Yes. She flushes his clothes down the toilet.
Yes.
And then, that movie's bonkers. I just saw that's it for the best first movie. Time, like, 2 weeks ago. Yeah, it's crazy. And I don't know what Tara Buchman's doing in it. It's great.
Yeah.
She's in, like, a film that somebody else is making somewhere else. And she was in Death Car on the Freeway, so she was also doing TV movies at this point.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So, a long time ago, I wrote an article. I ended up, it was on a website, but the website went away. And so I ended up publishing it on my blog. And it was, I did it in four parts because it was so long. It was called Small Screen Scream Queens. And the reason why we published it was because it literally took me 3 years to write it, because I was just getting into TV movies and I was really trying to see as many as I could to come up with these lists of women and all the genre movies that they made. So I did it like a countdown where I, started with like somebody like Valerie Harper, who was only in one or two movies in the 70s that were genre, and then went to somebody who made a crap ton of them, right? And so I ended up, my number one was Donna Mills. And so here's just a list of a few of the, or I guess this is most of her genre films in the 70s that she made for TV, including episodes of Thriller. So I'm bending here the rules, but Haunts of the Very Rich, Night of Terror, The Bait, Thriller, Someone at the Top of the Stairs, Live Again, Die Again, Thriller, One Deadly Owner, another thriller called The Killer with Two Faces, which is a great entry. She's in Who is the Black Dahlia? She was in Beyond the Bermuda Triangle, which is a really interesting film. Look What Happened to Rosemary's Baby, which is a questionable film. Smash Up on Interstate 5, which is an amazing film. Curse of the Black Widow, amazing. The Haunted Lady, Superdome, and Hanging by a Thread, which may be a miniseries, but I can't remember.
Yes, it was a two-parter. That's fun. That's Bert Convy and a bunch of people.
Yes, that's right.
Trapped in one of those
like the air tram kind of thing. Right?
Those things that go from like a ski lift kind of air tram. They get trapped in it, and it's that's fun. That's a fun one. That's Irwin Allen.
Yeah. And so, and that, those, and I feel like I'm missing movies, but those, that's, that, there you go. And so she was really making a lot of genre stuff. And just briefly, before we started recording, I was on Instagram and I followed Donna Mills on there, and she just got a Peloton, right? And so she took video of herself in full hair and makeup doing the Peloton, saying 81 is the new 20. So my queen just turned 81, guys. And she's spinning, and she looks amazing on that bike. And so I'm so happy. She's totally amazing. So here's something interesting about Night of Terror. So I'm going to read you one paragraph of a critic from Variety, and then I'll tell you what another critic said about it. So Variety hated Night of Terror. They hated it. It was two column length of hate. So here's just one paragraph. Night of Terror was a sordid telemovie that should never have been slotted in the 8:30 to 10 p.m. time slot. An hour earlier in the central, or an hour earlier in the central time zone. Cliff Gould's mean little teleplay was hardly the stuff for the young people available at the time. And withal, it was one of the more gross violations of the network's pledge to reduce violence in the early evening. He hated it. He thought everybody was awful. Yeah, I did not get that from that. But it does bring up...
It seems a bit, yeah.
Where television was going, and I won't go too deeply into it here, but one of the things I lecture about is what I call the small screen video nasty, and that's when Born Innocent kind of changed the face of primetime, and they created the family viewing hour. Because they thought too many young people were seeing too many violent images and it was creating aggressive behavior, which even the Surgeon General was like, not likely, but still. So, but then Kevin Thomas of the LA Times, he really enjoyed it. He found it to be diverting and suspenseful. And he said, performances are first rate all around in this solidly crafted thriller. Miss Mills brings to life a likable, ordinary character, always the toughest to play. And he also really loved Balsam and Moorhead and said they brought a lot of warmth, which I mentioned earlier. So we have two really different interpretations of the film. One is that it's a gross violation of the pledge to have less violence on television, and somebody who thought it was a really good thriller. And it's kind of, I don't understand how it got that far across the spectrum.
The first one sounds like it has an agenda that it's after to me, because that doesn't sound like the... I mean there is certainly violence in the first 20 minutes or so and right at the end, but the whole purpose of... It's not that bad to say that's the whole purpose of the movie. I don't think in the end it becomes more like these two people like finding a bond. It just happens to involve Chuck Connors wanting to kill one of them.
Yeah,
and that shit happens. Yeah.
That's all. Yeah, so like, yeah, just a really interesting kind of assessment of a movie that I don't think anybody could ever watch that way. And I think you're right, it must be agenda. But there was like this growing sort of anxiety about young people being able to see these movies with all the violence in them. And I think it's interesting that this is the first time that I've actually seen it appear like in a review.
Yeah.
You know?
I wonder too if with something like that, because you have someone reviews it like that and says, oh, this is so violent. Oh my God, I had to take my kids to therapy for a year. But the movie only airs once.
Yeah.
So to the people who think these things are terribly violent, they're like, well, I didn't see the movie, but look at the review in Variety. This must have been terrible, you know, because it's not something they could go see in the theater again. So once it airs, maybe even by the time you're reading the review, it's maybe already aired. And if you missed it, all you have in your mind is, wow, Variety thought it was the most horrible thing since, I don't know, Night of the Living Dead, Blood and Lace, I don't know, something.
Yeah, something. Yeah, even though predates Sex, Chainsaw, Massacre, they're like, oh my God, it's just bad.
It's worse. You got, and there's a little asterisk, and it says you're going to have to wait to find out what that reference means.
Just
hold on
wait.
For 2 years. Just wait. Trust us.
Yeah, it was just a really interesting thing, and I was like, wow, I've never seen such hatred for a TV movie that I thought was really sweet. But there you go. And so that's the background. This one had a little bit more because of Howard Schwartz's Emmy that he won for the cinematography, but. The next one, which we're going to talk about right now, is called You'll Never See Me Again, another ABC Movie of the Week, directed by our man, Chwark. I'm slowly learning how to pronounce his name with confidence.
Yes.
And Dan, why don't you tell us what this one's about?
Sure. I just wanted to say, I have Merrill open here, and page 136 is a picture of Jess Walton and David Hartman and You'll Never See Me Again. And for some reason, whenever I saw this picture, I thought of David Hartman when he was on The Virginian, and I always thought this was like a Civil War movie
or something. War dress, yeah, I could see it in there.
Yeah, and I also want to say that a few days before this movie, I Love a Mystery aired, which actually had made several years before, but I think it's a fun adaptation of the old radio show. And the movie The Stranger aired, which became Stranger in Space, and is on an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Oh, and then, of course, a week before, one of your favorites, Amanda, The Norless Tapes aired.
Was there anything else you needed to watch that season?
And then a week after, The $6 Million Man movie and The Marcus Nelson Murders, which is the Kojak TV movie. So this was a hefty time.
What a great time for TV.
Yeah. So in this one we meet the Blisses, and we're going to find out that name is a bit ironic as the movie goes along. And they're I was going to say young couple, but David Hartman, even in The Virginian, which was like 5 years before this, he always
looks 35.
He always looks old. Not old, but he never looks young. You know, not like John Carradine never looked young, not quite that, but you know, he never looks young to me. But it's Ned and Vicky, and they're married and they're having a nice time. And they're out in the woods having a lovely day together. They go back to, they've just recently married, and they live 2 hours away from her mother. She doesn't speak to her mother, but she gets a kind of strange note from her mom that's very distant, and it's implied that when she reads the letter, it says something like, "Love, Mother." And there's kind of a feeling when she reads a letter that, like, something's wrong with that, this letter. I'm calling Ma. She calls her mother. It's busy. She can't get through. And so she says, and it's I don't know what time it is, but it's the evening, and Ned's an architect. He has to be on this building site in the morning. And she says, let's spend 2 hours driving and make sure my mom's okay. Ned says no. They get in an argument, and it goes badly.
I suppose I have to wear a tie. You want me to wear a tie?
Why ask me? I'm just a child incapable of making such major decisions.
I'm sorry I called you a child.
And my mother? You've called her a hypochondriac.
I didn't say she was a hypochondriac. I said she got her hooks into
you. Oh, and you're immune to your parents, aren't you? That's why we spent 2 boring weeks in Minnesota.
Vicky, I said I'd go with you. That settles it, all right?
No, no, no. I don't want to do anything that doesn't fit into your blueprint.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's not in your blueprint to just take off in a car somewhere. You're a...
A what?
You never do anything spur of the moment. Never.
It's ridiculous. You're being ridiculous.
You're a planner. You make lists. You, before you go to bed, you put on your pajamas.
Right.
You're as predictable as one of your buildings.
My buildings are pace setters. They're avant-garde.
I didn't mean it that way.
Predictable?
Ned, I am sorry. Your buildings are beautiful.
Thanks very much. Where are my cigarettes?
You gave them up. Anyway, I don't want you to come with me. I really don't, Ned.
Hey, why are you going on like this? I said I'm going to go with you.
Well, you could say it like you meant it.
Do you want me to lie about my feelings? Is that what you want?
No. I don't want you to lie about anything. Even if it would make me happy.
Oh, wait a minute.
Don't!
That tone of voice is pretty hard to take, you know.
That's tough.
You are not going to talk to me like that.
Let me go. I'm leaving.
You're not leaving. You're going to stay right here and listen.
If you let go of me, or I'll bite your hand.
You're not going to do anything except...
day he's out at work and he's doing his thing, and when he comes home, and we do meet a co-worker of his who's very joking, you know, when Ned mentions that my wife left last night to visit her mother and hasn't contacted me. Well, Ned, she spent the night with me. And that guy's kind of a douche. And Ned, when he gets home, he discovers his wife isn't there. And he calls her mom, and her mom says she never made it there. And he goes to the bus station because she wasn't going to drive. She was going to take a bus. And the guy at the ticket counter says, yeah, I remember her. She forgot her money. And so she hitchhiked. She hitchhiked away. And Ned goes to the police, but the police can't do anything, unlike in that Shawnee Smith film, where they can, you know, go after a missing person within 2 or 3 hours. In this film, they have to wait 48 hours before they can find a missing person. And so he begins to investigate himself, and he drives down to where the mom is, and he stops at a gas station, and Bo Svenson is there playing Sam. And Sam sees a picture of her and says, I've never seen her. But a guy, a mechanic, says, oh, yeah, Sam spoke with her. But Sam says, I did not. And Ned leaves and goes to visit Mom, who he's never met before, and visits Mom and Mom's, I think Mom's new husband. I forgot exactly what he was, but the guy who's living with Mom. And they're both kind of like, yeah, no, we haven't seen her, sorry. And the guy there gets really mad at the way he treated Vicky.
Stupid argument. It was silly.
Now, don't dwell on it.
Dwell on it? What else can he think about? Of course, if he'd come with her.
I'm sorry. Don't you know that?
Well, it isn't your fault. She's a hot-tempered girl. Right, Will? Once we quarreled, and she stayed away for days. How many days, Will?
Why did you let her go off alone?
Now, please, Will.
We had an argument.
She could have called us.
She tried to call you.
I just don't understand it. A man lets his wife go off alone, hitchhiking down some dark road.
I thought she was on a bus. What are you saying?
Please, Will.
Look what you've done to us. We were fine. We were going to travel. We're going to start life again. Everything was fine.
Will, stop. You don't know what you're saying. Stop it.
Why'd you let her go off alone?
Ned ends up going back to his house. The cops show up, and they found her dress, Vicky's dress, in the back of his car with blood on it. And they say someone called them and said they think Ned did this. Ned kidnapped her or killed her.
Was that blood on the dress? Looks like it. The lab will tell us. Mr. Bliss, you know where your wife is? No. Who called you? Listen, whoever called you put that dress in the car. They didn't give his name. Well, doesn't that sound just a little phony to you? Oh, I don't know. Put yourself in his place, Bliss. He's somebody who knows you, somebody's worried about your wife, somebody who doesn't want to get involved. This sounds pretty normal, doesn't it? And the caller said that you were acting funny, irrational. That's ridiculous. Am I supposed to be calm? My wife just disappeared. Bliss, you did tell the sergeant that there'd been some violence. There wasn't any violence. I just slapped her, that's all. Not hard. She tripped. Looks like blood on one of your shirts. When I slapped her, she got a nosebleed. Maybe that's how the blood got in her dress. Maybe. Where did she trip? Show me. It wasn't a blow. It was just a little slap, you know? Show me. It was right about here. She just stumbled back a little, that's all. She fell.
She fell here?
Yes,
but... She hit her head here?
No.
She was dead? You panicked?
No, we just had a stupid little argument and she left, that's all.
What was the argument about?
What difference does it make what it's about? She left and now we don't know what's happened to her.
Look, Bliss, I could put myself in your place. It happens a lot. Two people say ugly things to each other and... Finally, one of them says something, the other just can't stand it here, and bam! You're a powerful man, Mr. Bliss.
No, that's not what happened.
All right. And how was it?
Listen, I just told you, don't you believe anything I said?
Doesn't matter if I do or not. By tomorrow, you may have changed your story 10 times. Happens all the time. You see, it's not so much that people lie, it's just there are sometimes, sometimes there are things that people won't let themselves remember.
Listen, what'd you say your name was again?
Stillman. Call me John.
Now listen to me, Lieutenant Stillman. I love my wife. Now, maybe she's dead, I don't know. But maybe she's alive. And if she is alive, maybe she needs help. The only important thing right now is to find her, and I can help.
And Ned, unfortunately, he freaks out on a cop, steals a car, and kind of goes on a mini, not a rampage, but he's desperately trying to find out what the heck happened to his wife and where she is before the cops get her and before everything falls down around him. And it's implied at one point that possibly he did this himself, and maybe he doesn't remember. I'm going to leave it at that. David Hartman on a mini rampage to find his wife.
Wasn't that the original title, David Hartman on a mini rampage to find his wife?
That's what it says in Merrill. You never see him again, a.k.a. David Hartman. Yep.
That's not quite as catchy of a title.
That's not as catchy, no. But it's mostly, if you like David Hartman, this is a film for you.
Because
he's up front and center. Yeah.
So I'll be honest, I've never seen David Hartman as an actor, really. I only know him from Good Morning America.
Same here. Apart from The Virginian.
Yeah, I had never really seen him as an actor. And so it was, he's just a genial host of like a light news show to me. And so
this
was sort of kind of neat to see. But I didn't want to interrupt your breakdown. But like that part where they have the fight, that's kind of like a very, I hate to use the phrase, didn't age well. But, like, that's upsetting. Yeah. There's some abuse going on there. Not that she's great, you know, in the argument, and I'm not defending her. But, like, at the same time, that got intense.
They do keep, I mean, that keeps coming back on him, though. Throughout the movie, it's like no matter what he's trying to do, somehow they always seem to know that you hit her. And that seems to always come back, and I never quite fully figured his character out. Maybe that's the magic of Hartman. You never fully know. but that was sort of one of the things throughout it, is that like whenever you think he's got a step ahead or he's about to find something out, somehow someone learns you hit her. Yeah, good luck. And suddenly like falls apart around him, and you're like, well, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have done that. But if she is lying half dead in a ditch, maybe you should try to find her.
Yeah.
Now, that may or may not be a spoiler, but I'll stop there.
And, of course, his name is Ned Bliss.
I heard that, and I thought, it was based on a short story. I have not read the Cornell Woolrich story that it's based on.
I haven't either, but he's a great writer.
Yeah, he is. So there's a chance he could have used the name Ned Bliss.
Completely possible. Nate, had you ever seen this before?
No, I had never seen this one before either.
So what'd you think?
I really like this one a lot. I find like movies with that feature missing persons and like you as the audience don't know what happened to them either. I find those very engaging because the movie goes on, you know, David Hartman is, you know, trying to track her down in every way that he can possibly think of. The fight that they had did definitely make me uncomfortable. You know, just the whole with her biting his hand and him like hitting her and giving her a bloody nose. I mean, that was rough.
Yeah.
I definitely did not guess what was basically what was going on, like where she was and what had happened to her. And, I mean, I was actually pretty shocked in the scene where, you know, he's knocking out the wall.
Oh, that's right.
And he sees the hand, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like, I can't believe this movie went there.
Yeah.
I'm like, I really wasn't expecting that. But I mean, of course, you know, there's nothing is exactly as it seems. I thought that the ending, I was kind of glad that it ended the way it did, but I will say for a little bit there, I didn't think it was going to have like a, you know, they lived happily ever after kind of ending. It just, something filled, this movie just kind of filled me with this sense of dread that I don't know, you just... It's very, it kind of reminds me in a way of, you guys have seen the Vanishing, right?
Yeah. Oh,
yes. Where it's just wanting to know so bad, you know, what happened to this person and how it can drive you crazy. And I found it very, interesting. Like, Dan had mentioned, at one point he's even questioning himself, like, did I do something don't remember it? You know, I mean, it's like it's driving him to that point, like driving him that crazy. I thought this was a hidden gem I liked it a lot.
Awesome. Yeah, this was a first time viewing for me too. I've been wanting to see it for a long time because I love Jess Walton, and I've seen her in stuff from this. I know her mostly as Jill on Jill Abbott on Young and the Restless, and she's still on there. But I knew her mostly as like the older soap actress and not like.
That's right, she is.
Yeah, that's Jill Abbott.
That's why I sat there the whole time going, what? Yeah.
She's been in lots of stuff, and like she was in. I think the first thing I saw her in, where she wasn't Jill Abbott, was an episode of the $6 Million Man.
Oh.
I think it was the $6 Million Man or a show like that. And it took me forever to figure out who she was because I kept saying, I recognize this actress.
Yes.
I recognize her. Why do I know her? Oh, she plays Jill Abbott. And she's stunning. She's just this beautiful woman and still beautiful. And she's such a talent. But she usually plays these kind of gruff. Like Jill Abbott is like, she's going to eat you alive. You know, and take no prisoners and all that stuff. So here she's playing somebody completely different. And she's also in The Victim, that Elizabeth Montgomery movie that I did the commentary for. See how I'm just dropping all these commentary things I did. But and when I was researching her, I came across this movie and I was like, yeah, I've been wanting to see this. So it's been on my radar. And of course, she's like in The Victim. She just shows up for a small portion of it, but she's welcome in anything for me. So this was really great for me to discover it. I don't know that I liked it as much as Nate did. I feel like of the two films, maybe Nate, did you prefer this one over the other one if you had to pick one?
Honestly, yes, I think I did. I think it's just my whole like horror personality. I found this movie to be a little more horrific.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you, but I think I liked the other one more. I like both of them a lot, but I think if I had to pick one, like if I was on a desert island, you'd have these two movies. But before I want to talk about what this movie reminded me of, because I feel like it's maybe a little spoilery. Dan, what did you think?
Oh, I really liked it too. Please, don't make me pick.
Yeah, I know it's hard, sure. Isn't it?
I know it's difficult because like I said, David Harmon to me, when I covered the mid '80s show Shadow Chasers on my podcast, Avengers Supertrain, at the end of every episode, because they were all taped off of whatever station Good Morning America was on, and so the credits would roll, and almost every single episode you hear, this is David Hartman. Tomorrow on Good Morning America, we talk about who does my hair, and should it look like that? Has a mistake been made? You know, and it's him on every time. And, you know, about 2 years or so ago, I saw he's on The Virginian for a season and a half, and he's pretty good on it. He's not one of my favorite characters, but he's good when he's on it. And I'd never really seen much of his. He's on San Francisco International, the TV movie.
I haven't seen that.
He plays the pilot who is ordered by the bad guys to not allow the plane to take off because they're pulling some sort of heist, and so he keeps bothering Pernell Roberts by stopping the plane over and over again. It's a fun, and I will say I have seen it in a standalone, and it's also a very funny episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. But it's good. It works on standalone too. Although I have not seen the TV episodes that are on 4 and 1, you know, where McLeod and the psychiatrist and Night Gallery. I think Night Gallery, didn't that come out in Blu-ray recently, the first season?
It did. It's exciting.
Is it? Do we know anyone?
Yeah, I've been pushing my commentaries, but I was really happy to be on that release too.
That's fantastic! I can't wait. I have the Night Stalker standing by here, and I'm going to be listening to your commentary soon on that. But that's all. No, what was I saying? I forgot. I was.
That you really like this movie, and David Hartman is David Hartman.
I did. I like Nate said, there's something about sort of the missing movies, like whether it's The Vanishing, or even that one from a few years ago, the video one. I forget what it's called. Melissa is Missing.
Oh, Megan
or something.
Is Missing. Is that what it's
Megan
called?
Is Missing.
I haven't
like that
seen
one.
That. I heard that's really upsetting, so I've kind of avoided
it. It is upsetting. Yes. I found it upsetting. But that's one like that too, where you know a friend, the friend that she's online with all the time, suddenly goes missing, and no one really seems to care. And then she sees this really violent image involving her friend, and she goes to track her friend down. But there's the thing with it, I think it it doles out the bits of information really nicely. So you get, like, he goes here and you get just a little, he goes here and you might get some, then he goes, I mean, they do something very clever, I think, which is when you hear Mom's voice, it's Jane Wyatt.
That's right.
And if you know, if, I mean, I know this now just because I mentioned Father Knows Best a little while ago, but in 1973, if you're of an age where you've been alive for 10 years or more, you probably came across the TV show Father Knows Best, where she is one of these sort of typical super sweet moms. So when you hear her voice on the phone, you're like, oh, what a nice mama. And then when he goes to visit her, you're like, you know, and he's getting like rough with her at one point. You're like, don't do that. What is Robert Young going to say? Wait, who played the dad in Father Knows Best? Was that it? What is father going to say? You know, Dr. Marcus Welby, MD, what is he going to say? And so they do it nicely because there's a bit of a twisteroo later on. So they kind of, to me, they were playing on the fact that, you know, this, it would have been like if it was Donna Reed. You know, or another famous, you know, mom from, you know, June Cleaver, you know, sure. Barbara Billingsley or something. You wouldn't have, you know, you don't expect Barbara Billingsley to know how to speak jive, which is why it's so funny. Just in the same way that you don't expect Jane Wyatt, like Nate said, when he slams through the wall and you see what's behind the wall and you realize that Jane Wyatt's complicit in it, you're like, no, not our nice mama. No, come on. And it's, I like that. I think they dole out the information. They give you just enough, and they ratchet it up when the cops show up, and he goes a little crazy. And he's clearly, at some point, it looks like he's going crazy. I mean, David Hartman has a big face, and when you put, sorry, Dave, when you get a close up of his face, he can look crazy pretty good, I think. And there are points when you think near the as we're drawing towards the end, like, oh my gosh, yeah, did he really do something to her, maybe? And he just, did he black out, or did, what's going on? And when you get to the end, maybe this is because, you know, it's just a few years after Night of the Living Dead, it's when so many horror films at this time had that zing right at the end, where you think, I mean, they did that in the 80s too, but in the early 70s it was more of a novelty, to, you know, you get to the end and you think everything's okay, then at the last moment there's just something, you're like, but up until the credits began to roll, I thought that the Blisses, one or the other, was in trouble. I thought something, just the way it's shot and the way it looks, because the music is going and going, and they're drawing closer to one another, but the cops are there too, and the bad guy is there too, and it all kind of, it really is nicely shot, it's nicely edited, and so I didn't, like the last 5 minutes, I didn't take a breath until the credits started to roll. Then I let a wow. Whew, that was nicely done, I thought. And so I think if you want, this is like almost a good episode. This would have been a good episode of Thriller.
Yes.
I think.
I agree.
This would have been a fun episode of Thriller. I think, thinking about them, at the moment, I know it's wishy-washy, but I can't pick one over the other. But I think this is it does do one of those things with, until they start to fight, there's a bit too much of, I love you, Mr. Bliss. I love you too, Mrs. Bliss. Oh, isn't it great? There's a bit, they ladle that on pretty heavy.
Yeah.
But you kind of know they're doing that because something's about to happen.
There was kind of this part of the beginning where I was sort of like miffed at Vicky Bliss, because she's like, I want to go see my mom, and he's like, I have to be on this new job tomorrow. He's like a architect or something.
Architect, yeah.
And you know, I'm just starting this new project or whatever. Well, I want to go to this place, and you're gonna take me. And I was like, wow, he's paying for everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't
want
to get into like a weird. I know that I'm crossing over a lot of lines here. But it's kind of like you have to let him go to his job. So like the fight was really frustrating for me, and it is. It's like she's gonna disappear over this.
Yeah, and then the point it builds to, and it's like, oh, it built to this awfulness just because of, and It is tricky. If you can get past that, once she says you'll never see me again and she leaves, from that point on, it's a very sharp thriller.
Also, her
dress.
First
10 minutes. Yes,
that's amazing. Yeah. I love that beige dress.
But I think maybe it's one of those things like. It's like, you know, I love Back to the Future, but the first 15 minutes or so before Marty goes to the mall really spreads on the, we're in 1985, really overdoes it, because the moment he goes back into 1955, you get to see the payoff to everything that they show right. in 1985. And in here, they overdo the fight, they overdo, they get it slightly wrong, like, it, they get it slightly wrong sort of about what it's about. It doesn't, it I mean, I guess fights escalate like that sometimes.
They do,
certainly,
they do,
but,
sure.
But and they ladle on the sort of romance. Like I said, the picture in Merrill's book, it looks like they're a Civil War romance. And so they ladle it on pretty heavy. But that just means that when she says you'll never see me again and leaves, you remember all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
If they had been more subtle, you may not have caught. You gave me a nosebleed. Well, you could have just shown that or something. She didn't have to yell that out.
It's definitely more shocking to see it. Yeah, you do remember it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I think that's that part of that could be adapting a story. It could just be the writers kind of just over doing something that's in the story and not making it as visual as
it
should be.
The one thing I wanted to bring up, and I guess this is kind of spoilery for another film, so if anybody here is listening, I guess go ahead a couple minutes, but I think I sort of could tell what was going to happen at the house, because it reminded me, and actually I didn't look up to see when the other movie came out, but they would have been around the same time, You'll Like My Mother with Patty Duke. Have you guys seen that?
I haven't seen that one. No.
Have you, Nate?
I don't think so. I've heard of it, but I don't think I've seen it.
Oh my God. Okay, well, now I spoiled it for you too. So You'll Like My Mother is very much like this movie in a lot of ways, and they remind me very much of each other, even though they're slightly different in the it's too much to go into. Anyway, when I was watching this, around the time we get to the reveal of what's inside the walls, I was getting a hardcore You'll Like My Mother vibe. And then I kind of could see where it was going. But that's only because I just watched that movie. It's not like this movie isn't unpredictable. You know, it's not like I'm trying to say, oh, I guessed it. Because I probably wouldn't have had I not just seen that other movie. But it reminded me so much of it. In so many ways, they feel very similar. Like, not exact replicas of each other, but like in the same family. Siblings, for sure. And You'll Like My Mother was directed by Lamont Johnson, who primarily did TV movies, except he did a couple of theatricals like Lipstick and You'll Like My Mother. And he had this really interesting career. Actually, I think he did other theatricals too, but those are the two that are sticking on my mind. And I just thought it was funny that they had a kinship. But if you guys haven't seen it, we can't talk about it. And I don't want to go farther than that because you should just see it. It's really good.
One of the things with You'll Never See Me Again that I realized as you were saying that is there is sort of a point in it where I don't know exactly if I can pinpoint it, but there's almost a point where like it could have been anyone, not just and that's kind of the thing I like about it. Is it Sam at the gas station? Is it Ned? Is it something to do with the mother? Is it something to do with that other the guy the mother's with? I guess her husband. I keep forgetting what his relationship is to her. It could be anyone. You really and there's something about it could be the guy he works with. You know.
That sleazy hot guy.
The sleazy hot guy who is sleeping with the boss's wife.
Yeah. Briefly, I was so happy it wasn't him because, so, like, we're watching the first part of the movie, and David Hartman goes to work the next day, and he runs into his sexy hot friend, and his sexy hot friend, sorry, he was sexy hot, his sexy hot friend was like, oh, don't you know I'm in love with your wife, and she's in love with me, and she's moving in with me. Ha, ha, ha. And then David Hartman made a face, and his wife hadn't been missing quite so long at that point. And so, And then as things start to unravel, he's like, oh my God, I think she's with the sexy hot guy. And I was like, oh, if I find out that he's, that they're really running off together, I'm going to be really mad because they implanted this so early on.
Yeah.
That it's and it seems kind of obvious that I'm going to be really angry. So when David Hartman shows up at the hot sexy guy's house and he's with a different woman, it's such a relief for me.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, okay, this is going to be, this is going to go somewhere else. This isn't going to go to some obvious end.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, unless you've seen You Like My Mother. And so.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, I also forgot the guy in the truck who takes her.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so you get that guy too, because there's all sorts of different places that she could have, because he really traces the path she took, and there are like four different spots where she could be.
It's interesting because she had no money, but she was able to get to the parents' house, and the bus guy saw her and remembered her. Oh, because she hitchhiked, right? She couldn't buy a ticket, so she just walked out. And you're right, they did trace it really well. And it's a fairly believable route, right? And then, and Bo Spence is actually uncredited, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I thought that was weird, too, because I sat there looking, isn't that Bo Svenson?
Who's even bigger than David Hartman? I think they even put David Hartman on a step at one point so he could be as tall as Bo Svenson, and he still wasn't as tall.
He still wasn't as tall. No.
That dude is tall.
He is. He's very tall. I want to watch Snow Beast.
Because his name is Bo Svenson. I always expect him to sound super Swedish.
Same here. Yeah.
He never does.
He always surprises me, yeah. I was going to pop in my Blu-ray of Snow Beast and maybe read the liner notes.
Stop it.
What? Sorry.
But anyway, so like... yeah, like it's... I forgot where we were going, but like... You're right. She does take a very believable route, and he does really trace... Mm-hmm. The minutiae better than the police do, you know.
Yes, and they do.
They just care about pinning him on the crime. Like, they've decided that the husband is the culprit.
He's done it, yeah.
And they don't even care what other options there are.
And that's the... there is that moment, too, I think, that sets the sort of... We don't know exactly, like, where the parents are, but there's something like where the wife says, like, well, we only moved to Denby, so we're just... We're only 2 hours away. She says that, which maybe is not the most, you know, easy line of exposition to deliver. but you then know at that point that mom is 2 hours away. So mom isn't, like, on the other side of the country or something.
Yeah.
She's within, say 120 miles or something.
Hitchhiking
like that,
distance.
Taking the expressway. Yeah, hitchhiking. You know, my dad, when I was young, he used to pick up hitchhikers.
My dad used to hitchhike, so maybe your dad picked up my dad.
Maybe, yeah. Gosh,
think about it.
I don't know. He used to keep pictures of all of them.
Shut up.
In the glove. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, he did.
Under the bed with a lock on it.
He did.
They were always bound and gagged. It was so weird.
It was odd. It was odd. I never figured out why he had a mattress in the back of his truck. But hey, who am I to ask?
Yikes!
I'm six. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Yikes! Well, my dad did hitchhike a lot, and just not to go too far off the beaten path here, but one day my dad was hitchhiking. And he got picked up by two guys who had actually just robbed, like, a liquor store.
Oh, good God.
And so he got arrested. And he was in the military at the time, and he was on leave, and he missed his time to come back because he was in jail.
Oh, no.
And finally, the two guys were like, he wasn't with us. We picked him up hitchhiking. So the police wrote a note, like an excuse note, for him being late. To come.
Hey, well,
yes. And they didn't put a date on it. So my dad stayed away for, like, three more days.
Oh,
and then came back and gave the police or gave the military people his note, and then they excused it. That's a true story.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's
so that actually happened to my dad. But he when he was in the military, he hitchhiked all over the place. So it was in the 50s. Wow. Everybody did it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And I mean, my dad, he only picked up young women who looked like Suzanne Plachette.
So he picked up three women.
Yes, more or less. Yeah,
yeah, that's
yeah. And I was like, and I remember one time, like, being in the car. I was maybe eight, and just like we passed a young woman hitchhiking. I was like, should we pick her up? And I said, sure, why not? I didn't know I was eight, and she got in the back, and we chatted for a bit, and we dropped her off like 2 miles down the road.
Wow.
She was dead. She was in a bag. No, I'm kidding.
Stop it.
It was like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
I picked up a hitchhiker once. It was a woman.
I never did.
Well, she wasn't hitchhiking, I should say. I was in the...
You've seen The Hitcher.
It was.
You know there's a female version of The Hitcher somewhere, like Hong Kong or something.
I was driving through Red Rock in Nevada.
Okay, sure.
And it was like really late at night, and I was with a guy, and we were on a date, and we passed a woman walking in the middle of nowhere. And so we picked her up, and it turned out that she was camping, and her she had to make a phone call, like a really important phone call, but the phone was like 5 miles away.
Oh wow.
So by the time she got to the phone and made the call and came back, it was dark.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and we just dropped her off at the campsite. It was, and I would never have done it if I hadn't had a guy in the car with me.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, I thought you were to say something like she was at a campsite with her friends and they were harvesting marijuana, and then the government dropped a bunch of crop dusting stuff on them and they all turned into zombies.
That would have been a better story.
But maybe not true,
yeah,
is the problem. And this is, we're about truth here,
yeah,
on the Made for TV Man.
That's right. So my story was kind of boring, but I have picked up, she wasn't really a hitchhiker. I just picked up a girl wandering down the road. But anyway, yeah, so I guess let's talk about where this movie goes, because we haven't really talked about the twists and twists. So David Hartman is, what would you say this was? David Hartman rages around looking for his missing wife, or whatever the AKA was when they shot this film, the production title. And he's just finding a lot of roadblocks, and I think he goes to the house for a while, the parents' house, and he gets frustrated and he leaves, and then he ends up coming back. And it comes into play. I guess you're right about it being really over the top at the beginning, because it's important that he's an architect.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because he's at the house and he's pretty sure that the mom has done something, but he's not sure what or where his wife is. And he's really upsetting this woman and he's freaking her out and he's yelling. And then he goes from the kitchen into, I think, the living room, and he looks and there's something wrong with the lining of the wall. Which is amazing, right? And yeah. And they do this great camera shot where they go back and forth between the walls. I can't tell the difference, but an architect can, right? Especially with all that gaudy wallpaper. And I'm like, this is...
That's a little distracting.
This is really becoming Bad Ronald, isn't it? And so I'm getting really excited about what he's going to find. And so he starts, like, hitting the wall and listening for that echo or whatever happens when you know that it's empty behind or there's a blank void or whatever. And so he knocks on it. He finds a spot. And he starts knocking it open. And, of course, like Nate said, you see this hand. And you're like, oh, my God, this woman killed her daughter. And then you look, and it's a woman with gray hair. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what? And, right? Because you have no idea who is this person, yeah, I've never seen before in the wall of this house. Is her mother a serial killer, right? And so come to find out that Jane Wyatt, who's Mary Alden, isn't really Mary Alden. She's somebody else. She's like the nurse or the housekeeper or something like that. And I think she's having an affair with Will Alden, the wife, the husband of the woman that's in the wall. And she, or maybe they're not even having an affair, but the mother dies unexpectedly. I don't think they murdered her.
Yes.
And they decide that they're going to use her Social Security or whatever she has coming towards her every month, and they're going to live on it.
And they say she has some stocks or something.
Yeah, she's got
like
money
too,
somewhere.
Or some,
yeah,
bonds or yeah, something like that.
And that they're gonna just hold, they're gonna hide her body and they're gonna collect the money and then they're gonna do something with it, like take off. And yet, but the daughter shows up, and of course, the second she shows up, she wants to know where her freaking mom is, and the things get harried. And so Will Alden, decides, played by Ralph Meeker, in a really interesting performance, by the way, he's really good in it. I gotta take care of business. So he's kidnapped her, and I don't know what he's done with her, but between when she left the house and got to Denby and David Hartman finding out what happened, because a couple of days have passed, I think, and she's not there in the house, but she's possibly alive. And so the cops are slowly, I think they're still thinking David Hartman's guilty, and they've decided to go to Denby to arrest him. And luckily, he's traumatized this woman so badly that she's ready to confess. She's already full of so much guilt about what's happened and feeling really bad. And I think she's worried about the daughter. And so when the police show up, she tells them, you know, Mrs. Alden's husband buried the body in the wall. And the daughter found out, and now he's going to kill her. And they're out in the woods somewhere. So you see David Hartman running through the woods frantically looking for his wife. And miraculously, she's still alive. And there's this great scene where he sees a grave. Do you remember this right at the end?
Oh, yes.
And you're like, oh,
the mound. Yeah.
Like, oh, my God, he got this far. Mm-hmm. And then he runs in and the grave is empty. And I remember even thinking, yeah. Oh, thank God.
Yes.
You know, I was so relieved. Yeah. And then he has to fight Ralph Meeker, who's like fighting air. Because he's like, like a paper guy. He's not really a very tough guy.
He gets the advantage because he's screaming and running with a shovel at Ned. But that's the main advantage he gets once Ned recovers from that.
Yeah, Ralph Meeker's not much of a
Mr. Elm's in trouble. Yeah.
And so Jill, I can't want to call her Jill because she's Jill Abbott. Jess Walton's character Vicky is sort of stuck in this little, I don't know what you call that, little area where she's hidden from him, like in the brushes or something. And she manages to get her little gag off and screams for help. And then everything is happy and they found each other. But it surprisingly ended up with a happy ending and pretty satisfying too, because I kind of think in TV movies you expect them to find the person. But I find that the surprise of the film is how invested you are in David Hartman finding her.
Yes.
Not the actual finding of her, but what when David Hartman finds her, you're just really invested in that moment.
They frame the moment you see her, I think they frame it really beautifully, because she's in the lower left-hand corner, and there's a tree that's right on the edge of like a small drop.
That's what it is.
And she's in the small drop in the corner, left-hand corner, and he's up in the top, like, right-hand corner of the frame, running, coming down the hill. But you can see from the way it's laid out that if she doesn't make a sound, he's just going to go by. He can't see where she is, even though we can. So as he's coming down there and she's trying to get the thing off, you're saying, come on, get the thing off your mouth. Come on, do something, make a noise. Come on, because you know he's going to run by. And if he runs by, there may be a chance. At that point, I was thinking if he runs by her, the cops will get to him first and end up shooting him.
That's right. Well, I think they must know, though, because I think the...
Something's,
I think Jane White's character told the police what had happened in the house.
I was still worried that they might see him like, David Hartman's coming at me and shooting him or something like that.
That's how
that.
We all react when David Hartman comes at us.
Because the very last shot is like them in that corner of the frame.
That's right.
Embracing, and the cops in the right hand where he was approaching them. But of course they won't see, you know, them either unless they make a noise or something. But then the credits start to roll and you're like, oh, thank goodness. Okay, good. All right. Give him a break.
We made it.
That's good.
Yeah, it comes to a really satisfying conclusion, and which is nice. I think both of these films... Oh, we didn't talk about the end shot in Night of Terror, but I think they both have great end shots. So you really talked very well about the end shot in You'll Never See Me Again, because it is framed really beautifully, because the cop does end up being where David Hartman is at first, and he can't see the couple have reunited. And it's just a really, whoever set up that camera shot did a great job of
it's a beauty of a
shot. That spot. Yeah. And then in Night of Terror, what I like so much about it is at the end, Donna Mills' character starts to get feeling back, and there's more feet. But she's in a field with Martin Balsam at this hospital. They're on the hospital grounds, and there's these children playing around her, and she's so excited to see them. And it's just this beautiful shot of all the kids running around her.
Yeah.
I feel like things are going to go back to some kind of normalcy for her, because that's what's normal for her, is being around all these kids, you know, and all this stuff. And so I just want to bring that up because I do love that end shot. So both these movies, I think, have really great, satisfying endings.
Yes.
You know, I would say Night of Terror probably has a more surprising ending, because I wasn't quite sure how she was going to get out of her wheelchair situation.
Yeah, it's more sort of, I don't know, visceral isn't quite the word, but it's a difference between her trying to struggle out of the wheelchair with like 2 minutes of David Hartman running through a forest, stopping every 10 seconds and going, Vicky, and then running some more, Vicky, and so that's, you know, there's tension in there.
Yeah, there is. Yeah,
but I think there was more because he's David Hartman.
He's a big guy. It's more suspenseful. Yeah. I just think that I like the other ending. There's just something really sweet and beautiful about it.
Yeah. Oh no. Under the actual ending. Yeah. No. Understood. Yeah.
So like all this stuff happens, but it's when they get to the body in the wall that you're just like, oh my God, that was what? just happened. Mm-hmm. And I love that because there's no way to have predicted that unless you've seen You'll Like My Mother.
There's the brief moment when he's waiting, Ned is waiting for the mom to come down the steps or something and talking to Ralph Meeker, and he looks at in the room and says, oh, the T square on this is off or something like that. I'm sorry. Vicky always says that I always look at everything like an architect. But the whole time he's saying that, Ralph Meeker is looking at him like, you jerk.
Oh, I know.
So you're not really thinking like he actually just spotted something really important.
Yeah. We were going to go away.
You just sort of think that for a brief moment he stopped thinking about how horrible his life is at the moment and just thought, this is an architecturally poorly designed room. And, you know, it's just nice back to get back to work just for a minute. But Meeker is there being his angry, I don't want to say little self, but he is next to David Hartman.
I mean, he's great in the role, but it's just, I can't imagine him beating up David Hartman. David Hartman beats up women, guys.
Yes. Oh, that was. And that, I felt like if I watched the film a couple more times, there'd be some sort of something in there that I wasn't fully getting about why he hit her right there. Like maybe there was something more to it than I thought.
I think it was just supposed to be an accident because, you know, clearly it threw him off too. It was just a thing that happened because you're right. The fight escalated. She got a little physical, which you're starting to walk into a really gray area with that, you know. Yeah, yeah. And I don't know that I'm qualified to argue one way or the other about why that's not good or bad. But, But I think you're right. I think it's one of those in the heat of the moment kind of things that he would not normally do, but the situation arose in such a way that it just happened, I think is what they're trying to get across.
I think part of me actually thought that in the end it was going to work out with, like, he'd find her dead and he'd get arrested for it, and somehow the message would be, he shouldn't have hit her.
Ooh.
Because that's what sent her away. That's what I thought was going to happen because they kept referring back to it. But in the end, when he saves her, she's very appreciative and he's very happy, as I would imagine you would be if you've been tied up by a madman in the woods and the only person you could trust who, even though he did a terrible thing, the fact that they can still, you know, she isn't like, keep away from me. She's like, okay, thank you. God, I hated being locked up in whatever extra wall he had.
Keep beating me up, David Hartman.
Yeah, it's tricky because you really do want to get the next, you kind of want to get like the next 20 minutes.
That's an after the credits, Nate.
That's an after the credits. Yep, that's you really kind of do want to see, like, they're going to have a bit of a rough time for a bit, I think, but I'm hoping they'll be okay because they were a sweet couple.
They were, yeah. I think it was hopefully just a thing that happened, and that they're real people. I really hope they get back together and work this out.
Yes, I really do too. My worry was that the cops are gonna find out. Okay, oh thank goodness, she's okay. But you assaulted the police officer. You stole a car. We've got about five things we have to take you in for.
He did a lot of things. He's edgy, this David Hartman character.
Yeah. The good thing is they did the freeze frame and the credits rolled, so we don't have to worry about it. And luckily, the You'll Never See Me Again TV series never happened.
Yeah, the pilot. This was
the pilot where she vanishes before the opening credits in every episode, and he has to find her. We went to Hawaii. We had an argument. She said, you'll never see me again. I don't know where she is. That would be fun.
So what I thought was originally going to happen was that there's a couple of movies like this that came out in the TV movie world. Ooh, there's one that I'm thinking of in particular called Honeymoon with a Stranger. Wow, I totally drew a blank. Honeymoon with a Stranger.
Janet Lee.
And
yes, yeah.
She gets married, and they're in Spain, and they're at his villa in Spain or whatever, and he goes to get like coffee or something, and another guy comes and he's like, I'm home, honey. And she's like, you're not my husband.
You're not. Yeah.
And so when they said we found her in the hospital, I thought for sure that woman was going to be another woman swearing that she was David Hartman's wife and that there was something else happening.
That scene actually breaks my heart.
Yeah, because when he sees her, do you know me?
He has, you know me. Please say you know me. And he's already completely emotionally busted by it, that he has nothing to give this poor woman who doesn't know who she is, who's completely lost. And it's like, oh boy, the trail of sadness that David Hartman leaves behind him.
That was the other title of this movie, the trail of sadness that David Hartman leaves behind him.
That's the they used to apologize for that at the end of every episode of Good Morning America.
Yeah.
We apologize for any sadness.
But I actually thought she was going to claim to be his wife, and we were going to find... I think One of My Wives Is Missing has the same basic premise as that, too.
Yeah, okay.
But,
Yeah, I think I thought that for a second, but then I do like the way they did it.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's, please help me, you know, who am I? And he can't say, I don't think he says a word, does he?
No,
he just
stares
backs
at her.
Off.
Like, what can I do?
Yeah, he kind of stares at her and backs off, like, yeah. It's like, I got a missing wife. I can't, do you want to be Miss Bliss? That would have been funny, because he could have taken her in, and then at Vicky's mom's house, there's a fake mom, and at the Bliss's house, there's a fake wife. Oh my god! And that could have, and then one of them could have lost their house. They all moved in together, and it's a sitcom.
This sounds like if I Carl Reiner could have created it during the TV movie game we play.
That does. Yep. Yep.
So save,
that's what I just
save
did.
That idea for the next game.
I will.
It's good.
I will.
So, again, this is called You'll Never See Me Again. It originally aired on February 28, 1973 on ABC. It is based on a short story, as Dan noted, by Cornell Woolrich, who wrote the short story that Rear Window is based on. And that's an incredible short story. It was written by William Wood and Gerald DePago. I hope I said that right. So Wood is somebody we've covered before. He wrote Death Car on the Freeway, which is a great TV movie. He also wrote Savages, which is wonderful, with Andy Griffith, and a movie called City Killer, which is bonkers, with Heather Locklear, Gerald McCraney, and I can't remember the other guy's name, and I'm going to have the wrong actor. It's a guy from St. Elsewhere, and he's the mad bomber, and he's bombing people to get Heather Locklear's attention, as you do.
Denzel Washington?
No. His name's Terrence Knox.
Oh, okay.
I get wanting to say Terrence Stamp, but I'm like, I know it's not Terrence Stamp. Don't say Terrence Stamp. It's Terrence Knox, I think, is the actor's name. And he's great in it. But DePago is a name that I'm just now becoming familiar with, but he's written a lot of really cool TV movies. And you would recognize his name from things like The Astronaut, also starring Monte Markham, which is, for me, a pivotal made-for-TV movie. Maybe we'll cover it one day. There's The Stranger Who Looks Like Me with Meredith Baxter, which is a really great drama about adoption, and Born Innocent, which we've covered on here, which is probably like the most notorious TV movie ever made. And then he did two Incredible Hulk movies, Trial of the Incredible Hulk and Death of the Incredible Hulk.
Nice.
This is a Wednesday movie of the week. It ran against on NBC Madigan and the Park Avenue Beat, and on CBS was The Sonny and Cher Hour and Medical Center. That's a groovy night of TV, if you ask me.
Yeah.
So it did really well in the ratings. It came in at number 18 for the 1972-73 season with a 23.7/36, which means 36% of households with televisions who were watching TV on the night this originally aired were watching You'll Never See Me Again. So that's a lot of people. That's almost 40% of an audience. So this was actually already adapted for TV in England in 1959. But it was directed by Ted Post, who's, you may know, directed The Baby. And it starred Ben Gazzara, and it was an entry in Armchair Theater.
Wow.
I haven't seen this, but I don't know if it's available, but I would like to watch it. And the only other piece of background I really have is I couldn't find anything on this movie, like nothing. But Kevin Thomas of the LA Times wrote a review. He did not like this one as much as he liked Night of Terror. He said, all told, You'll Never See Me Again is one of those films that isn't really so bad, just not very good.
I don't know. I think it's a fun, sharp thriller that doesn't outstay its welcome,
It's interesting because I think you guys like this one better than the other movie. I mean, I don't think you hated the other movie, but...
No, I think I just had more to say about this movie for some reason.
Story,
I don't know why.
Because there's more twists and stuff in this?
The joy of Night of Terror, or I was going to say Night of Horror. To me, the joy of Night of Horror is that it's a Civil War ghost movie and nothing happens for 70 minutes. But no, to me, the joy of Night of Terror is that it has that twist in it, where suddenly it's like the movie seems to be moving forward and then it just stops. Yeah. And it goes in a completely different direction, and I love that. But once I've said that I love that, I don't know that I have much more to say after that. Whereas the more I thought about You'll Never See Me Again, the more I like the construction is different in the two movies.
Yeah.
I think one is we hid her, when will they find her? The other is where is she hidden?
Ooh,
how will we find
so
her?
So good.
That's sort of what happens. You know?
Yeah, and this is a great introduction to I think I hate that I'm mispronouncing his name. Zeno Schwark. Because this was very early in his career. He was quite young when he did these, probably in his early 30s. And I think that they show what a really good director he is, because I guarantee you that even though we have no production history and you'll never see him again, it was another 10-day shoot kind of situation where they really put together a good film. And it sounds like he really prepares before he actually makes the film. And so we got a little inside look on him, which I'm really glad, because he's one of the last remaining directors, you know, in an era when these people were so important. And I know they get called journeymen, and sometimes journeyman is considered a negative, but for people like this director and so many others that made TV, they were just really good at what they did. I mean, this guy went on to make Jaws 2 and then Somewhere in Time. I mean, those are two, you can't pick two movies more different from each other, you know. Yes, and it's just a testament to his talent. So I was really happy to cover both of these, and I'm glad you guys enjoyed them both. I will say, I don't know when I'm going to be recommending we watch the next episode, but I'll have something and I'll put it on the airwaves when I've decided and everything. But we did get a piece of feedback, which I'm going to read to you, and then we will close out the show. So this is our friend Stan, who Stan Peel, who's a really great guy, and he actually listens to my Trapcast and sends feedback to that too, and I really appreciate it. So he wrote, "So glad you're doing another episode of Mayhem. I've missed hearing you, though I'm catching up on some old Eventually Super Train and Masquerade just started. You and Dan are hilarious as always. And thanks so much for featuring these two movies. I'd never heard of them, and I love them both, especially You'll Never See Me Again. There was something haunting and creepy about it. For a while, it seemed like The Vanishing." Here we go. So Nate said that. "Then I thought the wife had an elaborate gaslight going on as revenge, which I would have loved. I found David Hartman a little toxic." And I'm surprised you didn't throw out the David Hartman joke, Dan.
You're slipping. Damn it. That's why we got Stan standing by. Thank you, Stan.
I kind of need that. So they said, "Even at the very end, I thought the cops might shoot him before he reached his wife." Another Dan pointed that out. "Oh, well, maybe once it's all over, she'll wise up and run away with his pal, Bob." Bob was the sexy Hawkeye, by the way.
Okay.
"I loved Anna Mills in Night of Terror. She has a great wide-eyed stare that they put to good use. I appreciated how real and minimal the car accident was. We're used to movies having people walk away from worse accidents. But with those early 70s cars, it didn't take much to mess you up. Thanks, Ralph Nader. I do have to take issue with one problem with the plot." Oh, I think he hits on something we talked about. "Or the complete incompetence of the police. The guy killed outside the apartment has a child inside the apartment getting an art lesson, and nobody put that together. Okay. They specifically wondered why he would be heading for her apartment, and nobody questioned the kids. Luckily, the collage the kid made out of old tickets was so beautiful, the cop brought it to his house. Maybe I missed something. In any case, it's a small complaint. I love the final showdown between Donna Mills and Chuck Connors. Floor level fury. Take care, Stan." So thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Stan. Thank you.
He has a good way of synopsizing everything we took us an hour to say.
Yes.
So, whatever.
And I actually have You'll Never See Me Again playing right now. And right before he tears the hole in the wall, there's kind of a scene that almost reminds me a little bit of stuff from the movie Humongous, where they spend like a half an hour walking through the house, like finding dolls and in cobwebby rooms with, you know, cradles and weird stuff. And there's like a 4 or 5 minute sequence where David Hartman sneaks into the mom's house, and he's creeping through the house, and you just get these close-up shots of his sweaty face as he's picking up these dolls and things like that. And it's really, it's a little, I don't, disturbing isn't the word, but I'm sure they never showed this scene on Good Morning America, I guess is the best way to describe it.
We can hope. And so let's just talk about what we have going on in our lives in terms of work. So I, the only things that I have that I think are, have been announced that I can mention here is I did the liner notes for a slasher from 1982 called Deadly Games.
I
just got my copy today, by the way, and it's beautiful. Awesome. The artwork on it is so beautiful. And I also did a commentary with Justin Kurzweil from The Story Continues, Nate's partner, for a movie called Lipstick, which is coming out here in February, which is a really interesting rape revenge movie directed by a guy who primarily did TV movies. And it's a very interesting film, and also it stars Margot Hemingway, who I was thrilled to cheerlead because I love her. And just a little piece of trivia, I made a trip to her house where she died with a friend of mine, and we stood outside it and we cried. We are Margot Hemingway fans, and so this is a really good movie. I know the critics didn't really care for it when it came out, but it's really worthy of some praise, which I hope Justin and I did. So that's coming out through Shout Factory, and Deadly Games is coming out through Arrow. And Nate, do you have any commentaries that you guys have done that you can talk about?
We're on that Deadly Games disc.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I forgot.
Nice.
That's
exciting.
I don't know that we have anything else. I mean, we have some lined up, but of course I can't talk about them. But
you guys did Nothing Underneath, right?
Yes, we did.
Okay, because I got that. And I rewatched Too Beautiful to Die, which Rachel Nisbet does the commentary for that. I'm looking forward to listening to both. That's one of my all-time favorite movies, so I can't wait to listen to your guys' commentary. I know Justin's done a lot of research on it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, should be good. Dan, what do you have going on?
Yeah, the most recent things, yeah, with the Night Terrors commentary and the Phantom of the Mall, Eric's Revenge, liner notes.
That's right.
I wrote the notes, and you wrote some of the liner notes. I wrote some of the liner notes. They're some of the most fun liner notes you'll ever
read. That was a really fun project. That's a great movie.
It was fun to do. I hadn't seen that since like 1991 or 92, so it was fun to revisit it and write the notes. And they turned out pretty good when I read them, because we did that. Well, I did mine very quickly. I think you may have done also, so I'm glad they turned out okay when I read them. And my fourth book is out, From Beverly Hills to Hooterville, Exploring the Henningverse, 1962 to 1971. It came out in like September of last year, 2021. And you can go on Amazon and get it. It's out through a small press called a small publisher called Throckmorton Press, and it is available on Amazon. You can get it order to print to order. No, you order it and they print it and they send it to you, or you can get the Kindle version. And so far folks seem to enjoy it. I don't have a lot of reviews up for it yet on Amazon, but the reviews I have up there are nice, and the people who have written to me about it seem to have enjoyed it. And I mean, it's 763 pages. It's 666 reviews. So it's pretty hefty. So give it a try if you can. Like I said, I'm hopefully starting work on my next book soon, very soon.
Let me tell you where you can reach us. I don't know why I'm stumbling over my words now, but you'll find us on Facebook at the Made for TV Mayhem Show. You'll find us on Twitter at TV Mayhem Podcast. You'll find us on Instagram at Made for TV Mayhem. And you can contact us on Gmail at TVMayhemPodcast@gmail.com. So thanks, everybody. We're really hoping that we can make this a little more consistent. And I just appreciate everybody who comes around to listen. And thank you so much. And bye.